contributor to the committee really since its inception, and we're glad to have you officially on our committee now. Sherry, go ahead and give us a roll call.
Hero?
Yes.
Arnell?
Here. Can you hear me?
Yes. One moment. I have to mute myself. Sorry about that. Bagai?
Here.
Blazik?
Here.
Brady? Brownstein? Christensen? German? Dr. German? Laut?
Here.
Snell?
Ready.
Here.
And Dr. Beanstalk?
There we go.
Dr. Brady, can you hear us? I didn't hear us.
I know you're just, can you hear me okay?
Yeah, we can hear you now.
All right.
Thank you, everyone.
Can you guys hear me?
There was, we can hear you now, Dr. German.
Thank you.
Thank you, everybody, for being here. I know, you know, we were going back and forth with some dates and in person versus virtual, and I appreciate everybody making this work. Agenda item number 2, I'll make a motion that we approve the open session meeting minutes from January 24th.
I'll second that.
Motion and a second. All in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed? Motion passes, none opposed. Dr. Christensen, can you hear us? I just saw that you signed in as well. Okay, before we jump into the notice of proposed rulemaking, because I'm not sure how long that's going to take us today, I want to go to agenda item number 4, the adverse occurrence policy and procedure. This was agendized at the last board meeting, which the board voted to send to this committee. And we have it agendized for Friday's meeting, so we're hoping to get a recommendation from this committee today. Sherry, can you give us just a brief background on this?
One moment. April's going to give you the background. She's been working on it. Let me grab her.
Well, we're waiting for April. For the non-committee members that have logged in, I'm going to really minimize any discussion from non-committee members today. I want the committee to just remain focused and on task with trying to complete this. So if you raise your hand, I don't call on you. I apologize up front. But like I said, we're going to minimize that discussion. April, are you on with us?
I'm here.
Great. Can you give us some background on the adverse occurrence agenda item?
Okay, so this policy has been written down in a way to formalize what we have been doing. It's been updated, so it's not, it's the most accurate policy that we have to date as to how we've been handling AO cases. But what we really need is to make sure that this is the best way to go about it. If there's any any way, or I should say any part of the policy that should be adjusted in order to fit the nature of AO complaints and ensure that we are addressing this as thoroughly but also quickly as possible.
Thank you, April. And this was sent out via email today. So if any committee members are looking for what we're talking about, Yasmin circulated an email a few hours ago. Great, and we got screen share with it too right now. Dr. Blazek.
So just real quick question. So this is essentially formally written up as a policy to something we are currently doing. So the request by the board is for the ASC to give our input about making this into statute. That's what I'm wondering.
I would think rule, but April, do you want to answer that?
So as far as I know, it's neither. It's really just to make sure that this process is the best way to do it. And the reason we're presenting it is because we have been getting, I should say, just input from all directions as to what is the best way to handle these cases just based on the nature of them, which has been forcing staff to deviate from the written policy. The reason for that, because we're getting all these different directions, we just want to make sure that if we need to update this policy, we're happy to do so, but we need the input then, because at this point it's just staff who have established this policy and we just need to follow it. I don't know that this will actually require a change in statute or rule. That'd probably be a question for Ryan.
Thanks, April. And some background for the committee on this as well. You know, up until maybe a couple years ago, the AO cases were not really being prioritized. So the board wouldn't have it on an agenda sometimes for 6 months after the occurrence happened. And, you know, when I took over as chair along with Ryan, this was a focus for me to try to expedite, the AO cases so that the board has an opportunity to try to adjudicate it at the very next meeting. That's why there's been this change in policy. And as April said, it's been kind of an informal verbal change. And I think they're just trying to formalize that from what April's explaining. Ollie, go ahead, and then we'll go to you, Dr. Blazek.
Hey, thanks. Just the couple things I noticed in it, and maybe I missed it, but I didn't see anything in here that would make sure in policy that the dental board would report to the respective board if there's a non-dentist involved in one of these AOs. So that might be something good to add. The only other thing that I noticed is the time to report is 10 days. I know in various conversations, 3 business days to report a death or an event that requires emergency response is getting kicked around. So I don't know if we want to have the policy shorten it up, the 3 days required to report. Other than that, I thought it looked pretty good.
So to that last point, Ollie, and I agree with the idea of shortening the time frame to report. I'm not sure we can do that in this document, though, because that 10 business days is in our rules right now. So we may have to make that change in rule. I don't know that. I guess we would need the opinion of the AG's office or Ryan may know. That would be my only concern with trying to input that into this document.
Gotcha. Yeah, I was just trying to make it so it wasn't one more thing to change later.
Sure. But
I think you're right. You can't have policy that policy can't trump rule and rule can't trump statute. So that makes sense.
Dr. Blazek.
One of the things that jumped out to me off the bat was under the authority. They limit the adverse occurrence reporting to anything that has to do with anesthesia. And I actually think any adverse occurrence that occurs, whether it's anesthesia, anesthetic related or not, should be reported. A doctor could have a local anesthetic overdose in his office and that can end up going to the hospital. Doctor could have an asthmatic attack, and has to go to the hospital. And I think that if you limit it to just anesthetic instances, you may miss something. The other item I kind of thought about was, and this goes back to something that we talked about previously, where we think this board or this committee is doing a good job because we have representatives from all aspects of dentistry and anesthesia. What is the opportunity to not have the board make a decision about whether or not this adverse occurrence should become a actual investigation, and instead have a standing committee like this make those decisions?
I think both are great points, and I agree with both of them. I think, again, we might be getting into some rule changes, particularly with the expanding the definition of what an adverse occurrence is, meaning any activation of EMS. That probably goes into a rule change, which this committee can review that when we get to that point, but don't know that it can go into policy. I also don't know that we can make a standing committee to review AO occurrences with this policy. Why don't we, Sherry, I think what I would suggest is some of these points that are being brought up as far as reporting to the other, to a non-dental anesthesia provider board, shortening the time frame for adverse occurrences, broadening the definition of what would constitute an adverse occurrence, and the idea of maybe a standing anesthesia and sedation committee to review adverse occurrences, maybe those could go back to the board along with the approval of this policy, and board can comment with Ryan there and with counsel there regarding those four points that were brought up. Pat, what do you guys think about that? Dr. Blazek, go ahead.
Well, my only last thing, I love what you went with there, Dr. Hero, but is this timeline is very grandiose. I mean, to ask an investigator to get this done that quick is a big ask. I can imagine from some of the adverse occurrences that we reviewed early in this committee's formation, the packets were this thick, and the ability to, I don't know, maybe it should be considered, you know, in terms of the investigation, like change the wording or the timeline to where the investigation is started and maybe a preliminary report is given within 14 days and then a decision is made to, do we need to extend it, you know, on that fast track one that we were talking about. Because that is, I know if I'm an investigator, this is a big ask, you know, when I'm got a full practice, right? You know, because these investigations come with no notice, and you're going to say to, you know, a person like, hey, you need to take some time away from
definitely.
Your practice.
What is the time for, what's the turnaround time this is saying from assignment to a consultant to report back to the board? April, do you know the answer to that? Or Dr. Blazek, certainly go ahead.
14 days, you have to have the records. You got to have a conflict of interest within 10 days. Unless it's a fast track, then your conflict of interest has to be done within 2 days. Upon receipt of the conflict of interest disclosure, the assignment will be within 10 days, and you have completed within 35 days. The investigative report to be completed within 35 days. If you're on the fast track, the report has to be completed within 14 days.
April, you want to jump in?
Yeah, so I'd like to clarify. So the idea of this policy is that the records would be received and then placed before the board. The board would then determine whether it goes through the fast track or the regular process. So it would be then up to the board as to how many of these cases have to be on that fast track. Of course, if we are receiving a lot of adverse occurrences, you know, at once, and they all need to be fast tracked, that will be some strain on our investigators. In the regular response, though, the investigators always pretty much only have 2 days to submit the conflict of interest form. that's the same either way. It's the amount of time of whether to do the report itself, whether they have 30 days or was it 35 days, or the 14 days, which we cut in half. And the idea of that is because that fast track, we don't really have a lot of time to play with between one board meeting to the next. So there's not a lot of wiggle room there between what the investigators need to do versus what staff needs to do in order to get all of that documentation prepared for the next meeting.
Dr. Blasey.
What's the purpose of the fast track? I mean, I think the best thing this document does, in my mind, and what you've already mentioned, Dr. Hero, is if there is an adverse occurrence, it's being brought up on the next board meeting. Right. That's the best thing that you guys are doing, as opposed to somehow it lingers and doesn't come up for 6 months.
I think part of the idea, and then April jump in, is if there's a concern that a licensee poses an immediate threat to the public by practicing, rather than the board try to make that decision, and the board may, you know, obviously the board is dynamic. It changes, and we may have board members that aren't comfortable reviewing an anesthesia record and making that determination. So the need to fast track it could be in an instance like that where we want to get a consultant on board to quickly review and then report back. So if the board is considering a summary suspension, which we have to show as a board that they pose an immediate threat to the public, then we would want to expedite a turnaround time on that. April, go ahead.
I was just going to say, that's exactly it, Dr. Hero. The fast track process is reserved for a potential summary suspension. So if the board doesn't believe that a summary suspension is warranted, but, you know, a thorough investigation is in fact required, then we can go the normal route. The idea of the fast track is if the board is considering a summary suspension, well, we don't want to take our time on it, because then the argument becomes, well, if there's such a threat to the public, why did you take so long to do this?
Right. I imagine too, April, with this not being in rule or in statute, we could always modify this down the road if issues came up that we're not predicting right now.
Correct. Adjustments can always be made to the policy if we decide that something's not working the way we anticipated it.
Great. And any other comments, or does anybody want to make a motion?
I'll motion that this document is accepted as is and pushed back to the board with the comments that you made in terms of making any adjustments.
Hero will second. All in favor?
I second, yeah.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion passed. Comments that I relisted, two were from Mr. Bagai and two were from Dr. Blasek.
You want us to repeat them or the staff?
Well, I just want to make sure we have them. I know it was shortening the turnaround time from reporting an AO from 10 days to 3 to 5, reporting to the appropriate board if it's a non-anesthesia dental provider, broadening the definition of adverse occurrences to include activation of EMS regardless of the patient was sedated. And Dr. Blasek, you had one more.
And I said that why not consider a standing committee will be able to review these things, okay, and make recommendations as opposed to leaving it to the board, where sometimes you may only have one or two people who have any anesthesia background.
Right. Okay. Yeah, I want to make sure those aren't lost along the way. Okay, great. Then let's back up to agenda item number 3, notice of proposed rulemaking. So, Jessica, are you on with us?
Yes, can you guys hear me?
Great, yes, we can. So I think we should be right on the 1304 permit. Is that right? That's where we left off?
Yes.
Great. Now, there's been some modifications that have been circulated amongst the committee members. Dr. Brady, can I put you on the spot to maybe present your recommendations and we can discuss from there?
Sure. So my my documents were circulated kind of late to the game a little bit, but looking through a lot of its red lines, it was hard to superimpose mine on top of these other red lines. It's been such a dynamic process with the 1304 that I just went back and I redlined from the original document what insertions and deletions that should that I feel should take place. In those revisions, what it ended up doing is I wanted to look at a few different objectives. One objective was to be able to fast track a 1304 permit for dentists that are working with known providers, known non-dental providers. So that is in there. The other thing too, it puts all the standards to the same rule if they're doing general anesthesia as a 1301 permit holder. So anything that we specify in equipment, supplies, how they need to calibrate to any rules we have in there, even with the pediatric endorsement, the non-permanent anesthesia provider has to be on the same board with that. So everyone has the same standard. There's one authority that is the dental board that governs what happens in the dental office. The reporting of that will be such that it goes to all parties of interest. And there's an application for the dentist to essentially vet what non-permanent anesthesia provider that they're bringing into their office. So there's an application form that I've also circulated in there too. So, and I think that puts everyone as close to the same playing ground as we possibly can get. You know, there's a little statute change thing that I put in there, but really the only thing that was for is to see if we could put into rules such as other states have done, where it basically says that the dental board has the authority to stop an individual. So if there's an individual provider that is, just like we have these fast track processes in place, regardless if they're a dentist or not, can stop them from performing services in a dental office until the correct investigation can take place. So that's what those objectives were for. That's how I redlined the 1304. And it really is pretty simple because all we're doing is using the 1301 as a pointer within the 1304. So if you want to share it, we can go, I can go through my ideas with what was in there, what's in that revision.
Yeah, I think that'd be good, Jason, if you could do that. Ollie?
Thanks for your work on this, Dr. Brady. I agree with much of it. I think scrapping, I brought it up a few times, where that red line in our agenda document is a hodgepodge of a few different ideas that kind of all wound up in the red line. So it's utterly confusing and doesn't make a whole lot of sense based on like three different directions that the committee was going at various times. So I think scrapping it is great. I'll have some comments, I think, as we kind of go through rather than just put them all at once. If we're going to just go through what Dr. Brady put out, then maybe that'd be a better way, more efficient way to go through it. I didn't, and maybe we'll get to it and you can point it out, but I was trying to see where it is to the point that you put in the body or your email, Dr. Brady, about how the dental board would have the capacity to say that a certain non-dentist provider wouldn't be allowed in dental offices. And then probably talk about that more, but I didn't see where that was. So we could probably talk about that when you get to that, but I definitely think the 1304 section that's in the agenda is a dumpster fire. So this is a much better way to go.
Board staff, are you able to share Dr. Brady's document so everyone can see it? And Jessica, have you seen that document?
I'm not sure that I have.
Okay. So,
let me try to present it and I'll send it to Jessica.
Perfect. Thank you, Yasmin. Well, you're working on that, Dr. Arnell. Go ahead.
I just wanted to say, I've I've spent a lot of time over the past several days reading all the various versions, including the original and now this one that Dr. Brady has produced. And a lot of times it can be so confusing when we're focusing just down on the details. But if you take a step back and look at the whole document and what it accomplishes, I just want to say that I think what Dr. Brady has put together is elegant and simple. And I think it really does take care of everybody's interests. And I would just say before we start going through it, if we focus more on the big picture and how it watches out for everybody's interests, I think this is a really great place for us to start to work from to make something that is usable and good for everybody.
Great. Thank you. Dr. Blazek, Dr. German, Dr. Beanstalk, have you guys had a chance to see Dr. Brady's modifications?
Yeah, I agree with Dr. Arnell said there. I really like it. The only thing that I didn't see in there that I kind of liked about another document that was circulating was the requirement for someone who has a 1304 permit to show some type of proficiency in that they're doing a certain number per year. I think that there's some benefit to a doctor who's providing anesthetic services in an office that he does more than one a year. And I think that was Dr. Caputo had sent a letter out, and I'm just reviewing my notes. I kind of like that idea because for a dentist to try to provide anesthetic services in his office once or twice a year, I think is, again, it's a patient safety issue. And I didn't see that in Dr. Brady's document. That's why I bring it up.
Great. Dr. Brady, what do you think about adding some language about that?
You know, I think that's probably appropriate. I don't have too much of a concern with that. And maybe that what you end up doing is if the dentist with a 1304 permit, say they have like a special needs case that they rarely come across the need for anesthesia, and I'm just talking globally, if you're permitted at a 1301 or not, to put everyone on the same page. I think we have to look at, well, maybe there's a certain standard or requirement that could bring on someone to be able to provide those services. That's the only hiccup that I have with it. I mean, I don't know if it's a big enough barrier to access of care, but I mean, I'm not opposed to it. It's just something I think we have to kind of take with that in mind too.
Dr. Arnell.
Since what we're talking about is specific to the 1304, wouldn't the onus for that experience be on the provider that's brought in? The 1304 isn't to make a provider who wasn't trained in anesthesia capable of providing anesthesia. It's to allow them to bring in the provider who has the onus for that experience and expertise, right?
Dr. Brady.
Yeah, I tend to agree with you. It's almost like whatever we put in the 1301 for the staffing requirements of it, at that point or so everyone is kind of in the same page. Yeah, I think it's something we have to look at, what that verbiage would come out looking like. Because I don't think it's necessary. It's not a bad idea. Like, it's definitely a good idea. It's just that I don't know how to actually implement it right yet.
So, Jessica, what's on screen right now? Is this Dr. Brady's document?
Yes.
Great. Why don't you, Jessica, then why don't you just kind of walk us through, and Dr. Brady can jump in as well, and then committee can make comments, just line by line with this.
Sure. So it looks like the proposed language is changing 1304 to indicate that the permit would be to employ or work with a non-dentist anesthesia provider. Not much is changing, except, so my recommendation would be, when we talk about defining something, instead of defining it here in this rule, I would actually pull it out and put it in the definitions section. And then just use this as the definition.
Dr. Brady.
Sorry, it's cutting in and out. I don't know if it's my internet that's low bandwidth, but I don't know if anyone else is having issues with audio.
I've been having you cut in and out, Dr. Brady, but nobody else. So
okay, I'm going to turn off my video just to see if that helps.
Dr. Blazing.
I was just going to mention, I thought we did give a definition for the non-anesthesia or the non-dental anesthesia provider already. Didn't we do something like that?
Yeah, I remember us talking about it. Jessica, can you look back and see if we made that modification in definitions already?
Yes. So we had added proposed language that says a non-dental anesthesia or sedation provider means a physician anesthesiologist or a certified registered nurse anesthesiologist. Oh, excuse me, nurse anesthetist. Sorry, that's a difficult word for me.
Okay, so we've defined it previously, so here we can just use the, we don't have to redefine it.
Correct.
Okay.
Okay, so if you are happy with that language, we can move on then to A1. Again, it would be the non-dentist anesthesia provider meets the requirements of 1301. We'll double check the internal references. Again, just changing all of those references to the non-dentist anesthesia provider. Brings this down to 2. On forms provided by the board, provide a dated and signed affidavit attesting that any dental office or dental clinic where the dentist provides treatment during administration of general anesthesia or sedation by a physician, anesthesiologist, or CRNA. Again, I think we could probably change that to the non-dentist anesthesia provider. Let me just take a note of that.
There's a few spots like that we'll notice, I think, Jessica.
Okay. Okay, so on the forms provided by the board of general anesthesia or sedation by, we'll change that to the non-dentist anesthesia provider, contains all properly functioning equipment and supplies specified in 1301-2A during the provision of anesthesia or sedation.
I like that, just to reference 1301. It's nice. It just keeps everything simple.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Okay. And then removing all of this other information about the equipment brings us down to B, maintains a staff of supervised personnel capable of handling procedures, complications, and emergency incidents. All personnel involved in administering and monitoring general anesthesia or deep sedation shall meet requirements specified in 1301-2B.
So this is where I was talking about
Blasek's point. So if we want to put something different in staffing, we would put it in that part of the regulation. Does that make sense?
That's great. It just makes it so much easier to keep it all uniform.
Well, this section here, what it's dealing with is talking about the level of training of the additional people in the operating theater, correct?
Correct.
And so what that means essentially is that the dentist who's providing anesthesia, they must have ACLS or PALS, and then the assistants must have BLS, correct?
Correct.
Okay. So I just wanted to clarify what that meant. And specifically what I was talking about is if we set a minimum number of cases, you know, that should be show proficiency on a yearly basis. I appreciate what you brought to point though, Dr. Brady, and you know, we're really worried about the anesthesia provider, not so much the dentist. I don't know. I thought it seemed like a good idea when I read it the first time. You know, the idea of showing proficiency that you're used to doing anesthesia on someone, you know, or doing dentistry on someone who's asleep. I don't know. I think it's different than you know, not doing it when they're asleep.
I agree with you. I think maybe what we can try to do is try to find somewhere to add language in that 1301-2B to reflect that.
Dr. Snell.
I just have a question for Dr. Blasek, just to clarify, help me understand. So are you saying the number, the required numbers that we might be proposing is for the dentist or the anesthesia provider?
I'm thinking for the dentist. Like, I think if a dentist wants to renew his 1304 permit, he has to say, hey, I'm averaging 5 to 10 cases a year. Because if he's doing 3 cases in 5 years, I don't know if that'll be a really safe environment.
So then I have a follow-up question, if I can. Would that apply to a dental anesthesia provider that is going in and providing anesthesia to that same dentist, or would that only apply to non-dental anesthesia providers providing the anesthesia?
That's a good question. I personally would think it would apply to both, but I'm sure that's going to be met with some disagreement.
Yeah, I totally agree. It's totally different. I just wonder what Jason was saying early on. Do we limit? There's not tons of individuals who do, say, general dentistry on that population that might require sedation. So it may only come up, excuse me, once or twice a year, or a few times every 5 years, whatever it might be, for some, and I'm looking more at the general dentist crowd, for regular routine dentistry. Are you going to limit the ability for that individual to provide that service, or the patient to just get that service more readily, since there's not a lot of places they could go to have that done? That'd be my concern with that.
I think that is particularly, you know, that's a particular challenge for dentists outside of the greater Phoenix Valley. For the rural dentists, I used to be a general dentist practicing in a rural area before I went to anesthesia. And it was, you know, special needs patients up there need attention as well. But you just don't get a whole lot of them. And, you know, the responsibility for making sure it's that safe environment, I would say, is the anesthesia provider. And if they, you know, every anesthesia provider needs to be able to decide on occasion if that maybe a particular office isn't a good fit for anesthesia.
Dr. German, you had your hand up at one point.
I was just going to say, as far as the anesthesia providers, most of these permits have a currency requirement for the anesthesia provider. The question that Dr. Blasek brings up about the dental provider is an interesting one, and I think it's a valid concern, because when you have teams that do stuff repetitively together for at least enough times, that brings a certain level of comfort. in crisis situations. Not that crises happen a lot, and certainly not something we want to happen. But I think there is validity in his concern, and I don't know, you know, to Dr. Arnall's point, when we do the benefit risk ratio in the discussion, to what point do we actually install this language or wait and see how things play out? But I think, Randy, I think your concern is very legitimate.
There may be another way to accomplish the same goal. You know, if it's a dentist who rarely does anesthesia, maybe, I mean, I'm just throwing this idea out there. This might not be something that people want to entertain, but maybe an anesthesia provider working with a dentist who rarely does anesthesia, maybe that anesthesia provider has a requirement to bring a staff member with them or something so that there's still that team dynamic.
Dr. Brady.
Yeah, it's a good point. And the theme, I think, is for all, right? It's for all anesthesia providers, regardless, separate of the person that's doing the dentistry, because there's culpability on both parts. There's events that happen that, you know, the dentist in a crisis situation may freeze up and run to another room, and we have the anesthesia provider dealing with all the crisis management, definitely a breakdown of the team mentality. So it's a valid point. It is a more of a global part of it. So I think it does need to be somewhere. We need to massage that and figure that out within the 1301 portion of it.
The other advantage is not just comfort or comfort in a crisis situation, but more appropriate case selection. And I mean, we all know the more anesthesia cases we're doing, the more you really appreciate how important that case selection is. And I think that's something we see on a board level, where a lot of the issues that come up, whether they're anesthesia related or not, go back to improper case selection. And, you know, that's a hard one because, you know, I don't know that there's, you know, a CE mandate that we could put for that. So I think we kind of inadvertently accomplished that by having this currency put in there. But that's what was rolling around in my head. Dr. Blazek.
Well, you know, to Dr. German's point and Dr. Arnall's point, I would be willing to say, if we wanted to modify, let me back up. So to their points, having a team model is kind of the idea. And I know, you know, Ali and I have talked about it, that, you know, oftentimes he'll have an anesthesia assistant with him, you know, or a second provider. I know, he has his team he brings to every office he works in. And I know when I've hired, you know, a dental anesthesiologist, typically they bring a second provider to my office. And I think that's kind of the idea, is that for a single anesthesia provider to show up to a dental office where the dental office is inexperienced or doesn't do it on a routine basis would be in error, and could be really catastrophic. If you have an anesthesia provider that at least brings one or two other individuals that are there to provide, you know, care in case of adverse issues, I'd be willing to, like, say, don't put it here. Let's put it in a different spot if it's appropriate there. You know, maybe it has to go under mobile, you know, under mobile provider, that person brings an assistant or something of that nature.
Dr. Arnell.
What if, I think maybe a simple solution would be to make it either or, right? Like, maybe the 1304 meets the currency requirements, and that's great. Or if they don't meet the currency requirements, then the anesthesia provider brings a staff member with them.
Would there be certain educational requirements we specify for that staff member?
I think, wouldn't it be kind of what's same specified in 1301?
Yeah, that's what I'd say. Yeah, it's an assistant that's there to help, you know, and I mean, personally, I've worked, you know, with you guys, and I know that's what you do. You bring someone who is a highly trained assistant, you know, much like my practice is here in the office. So.
Yeah. I totally.
If it goes here, if it goes in this spot, I think great. I'm fine with that either or.
I think the theme, I think the theme of it being in the 1301, it's using that as a pointer so that everyone has the same obligation.
Well, there's definitely consistency at that point, so we're not putting a requirement on a non-anesthesia provider that a licensed dentist anesthesia provider doesn't also have.
Can we maybe try to come up with language, maybe at the next meeting, circle back and look at what that would look like?
I mean, we can do it right now. I mean, we're in the thick of it. It might be worthwhile fleshing this out while we're having a conversation, if you want.
Do you want to go back to the old document on the 1301?
Jessica, do you have a record? Do you want us to go backwards and flesh this out right now? Do you have a preference?
I think my preference, just so we don't get lost in a lot of these tangents, maybe we just earmark it and go back.
Okay, no problem.
Yeah, I like that idea too.
Yeah.
Ollie, you got your hand up.
Yeah, I was just going to add some comment and questions on the idea of the, you know, anesthesia provider bringing in an assistant, like what minimums, but if we're going to earmark that and talk about it later and bring it, I think it's appropriate to have it in 1301. And have 1304 reference 1301, but so I'll just bring that stuff up when we get to it over 1301 review.
Okay. Well, then let's earmark it, and Jessica, you can keep us moving along.
Okay, can you guys hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. So, sorry, give me 1 second. Okay. So what I did while you guys were talking, and I can switch it back if you don't like it, basically I just cut down the reference.
I like it.
Okay. So that brings us to subsection D, a dentist may obtain a temporary section 1304 permit, allowing them to utilize an established non-dental anesthesia provider if the dentist has submitted a section 1304 permit application to the board, has met the requirements as specified in subsection D, and is awaiting an on-site evaluation by the board, and on forms provided by the board provides a dated and signed affidavit attesting that the named non-dental anesthesia provider they are utilizing is an established non-dental anesthesia provider for another section 1304 permit holder.
Dr. Snell.
I think we skipped C, the top right of that column. Sorry, Jessica.
No, that's okay. I didn't see anything in C.
I just have a question. Sorry, you're right. There's no edits. My question is maybe a clarification on C to B. It says proper documentation of controlled substances. Is the office, the 1304 provider, the dentist, are they the ones that are supposed to be holding that perpetual log of medication, which would suggest that they own the medication and order it and dispense of it and deal with that? Is that the way a 1304 is that what's going on currently? Ali might have, he probably works with that a lot. I don't know.
Dr. Arnell.
If you have a DEA permit, it resides with the DEA permit holder.
Ali.
Yeah, I could just elaborate on that a little bit. So, when you order controlled drugs, you need to have them go to a DEA number that's assigned to one specific address. So, I know for our group, we have the dentist for the controlled drugs order it to the place where it's going to be administered. And so they keep it safe and appropriate there. And then the non-controlled medications, you know, emergency drugs and whatnot, those can be transported. But for the controlled stuff, in my opinion, best practice, and the DEA gets a little bit fuzzy on brown bagging, but my opinion is transporting controlled substances from office to office is not best practice.
Right. So the provider, the dental provider that you work with, they know that they have to, you've let them know that they have to be the ones that are in charge of ordering and keeping track of all that stuff. So when the examiner goes in, they tell the dentist, hey, I need to see your log, and they should be able to produce that log.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's okay. Under their DEA number.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
They're responsible.
Okay. Okay.
Ali.
Yeah, so just thinking on the temporary 1304, you know, I like the direction of that because of the delays that we've seen in the past. You know, my thought with the on-site inspection with the 1304 is, you know, a dentist could have my group come in and help them through a permit. And I bring in all the equipment, supplies, monitorings, emergency drugs, right? And then they get the permit and they decide to bring in whoever, who maybe doesn't have the same equipment, drugs, and supplies. So, you know, I just sit here wondering what validity there even is to having to require an on-site evaluation at all if the person that's going to be bringing in, the anesthesia provider that's going to bring in all of the things that need to be checked off on the on-site evaluation may not even be the person that goes in there to provide the anesthesia services. So, you know, I like the idea of a temporary to be able to get things expedited. I just don't know what we really accomplish with the on-site evaluation when you don't know what provider or group is going to come in after that person obtains the permit.
Dr. Beanstock.
Why do we need a temporary permit?
Dr. Brady, you want to jump in on that?
Sure. So for the temporary permit was so that a non-dentist anesthesia provider can work at an office that already has a 1304 or work at an office where they do not have a 1304 permit. I think the 1304 permit is definitely a valid process for the dentist to go through. I think on a temporary basis, they can have that 1304 permit, but the board inspection to it is the same as the board inspecting all dentists, including oral surgeons, dentist anesthesiologists, that they understand have an educational component of what's all involved and be challenged to that degree. If not, then no permits. I mean, you know, no evaluation should be necessary. I feel like it's all or none. I think the only way that the temporary permit could happen to address Holly's board is that they have to already, they can only work with non-dental anesthesia providers that they've done this form with, that vetting criteria. It's in the rules and regulations that they have to make sure that they meet those criteria. They have to dentist, the onus of responsibility is on the dentist to make sure who they're bringing in. So you can't go through all that hard work, with Ali to get a 1304 permit and then turn around and just hire a CRNA without going through the non-permanent anesthesia provider application. Cause it's on the responsibility is on the dentist to make sure that they check all the boxes. So they're all held to the same standard. And if not, I mean, you know, then and if they do, then it's just a competition thing, right? I mean, that's just the way that it is. But that's how and why that's important to be there.
Dr. Beanstock.
Do we have temporary 1301s and 1302s and 1303s?
Susie.
We do not have any temporary sedation permits.
So my question is, why do we even need this? I mean, I understood what you said, but still, why do we need it?
Well, I don't, and this is Suzy Board staff, if there isn't currently a temporary permit, if the doctor needed anesthesia, he would just need to hire either a medical anesthesiologist or a dental anesthesiologist while he waits for his 1304 permit if he wants to hire a CRNA.
Or medical anesthesiologist.
Well, medical and the CRNA would be the same. Susie, do you see this being an issue for board staff trying to expedite a temporary permit?
I don't. I mean, if you call not having an evaluation or not having anybody go in and check that office as being expediting, because that's really the only thing you're doing. You're letting them have a permit without anybody in, nobody going into that office to check it. So would that speed it up? Oh, probably, because currently they would have to schedule with an evaluator, and my evaluators are essentially volunteers that have their own practices and hold their own calendars. So if they could do an application for a 1304 temporary permit today and start hiring people tomorrow, that would be an expedited process, because nobody would go into that office to see that you could walk around the chair, to see the things that you need to see in the office. So it would be expedited, but we currently don't have any other expedited permits.
Yeah, and I mean, my opinion is the biggest delays are with new grads, right? I mean, new dental anesthesiologists coming out of residencies, new oral maxillofacial surgeons coming out of residencies. They're the ones waiting the longest for these permits. And so to create a temporary permit for 1304, I'm not sure I really see the value in that. And I do think it's going to create an extra layer for board staff, and board staff's already stretched thin. Lifeguard, I see your hand up. I'm not calling on non-committee members, though. I apologize. I don't know who had their hand up first. Ollie or Dr. Arnell?
I think I had my hand up first, but if I can just advocate for the opposite view for just a moment. Yes, when we look at it in isolation, this paragraph in isolation, it can seem like maybe it's unneeded, but when you look at it in the context of the whole design of what Dr. Brady has done, it's not a temporary for just anybody to come in, right? This is a temporary permit for a non-dentist anesthesia provider that's known to the board, right? They're working in other offices all over the place. They've already signed the affidavit saying that they'll bring all of this equipment and so on. And so when this general dentist that doesn't have a 1304 yet calls, for example, Lifeguard Anesthesia, all they need to do is send a provider that is known to the board that's already filled out this kind of demographic form for the board. The board knows who they are. They go in on the temporary, and I think it's kind of a nice thing, because it's, you know, just like how we have for me to get a 1301, I have to do an on-site evaluation, and then I'm known to the board, right? For the non-dentist anesthesia provider, they do their on-site evaluation, and then they're known to the board, and the temporary 1304 allows them to a little bit more seamlessly take care of their clientele. I think it's
right.
I like it.
And that was the objective. It was to make it so that they could participate in expanding their their business with other dentists without having to go through another hurdle or 2 to 3 month block where a 1301 permit holder would not have to. But it also puts everyone on the same standard, right? Because the standards for them to even get into that process is they've had established a 1304 relationship with an existing dentist. So if they're affiliated.
Have we defined what an established non-dental anesthesia provider is? Because we're using that term established, and I guess that's also a question for Jessica. Does that, who are we talking about established? I don't know that that's defined or not.
It's in reference to a form that Dr. Brady included with this language, okay, where when somebody applies for a 1304, they give kind of like a credentials sheet of the person that they're bringing in. When I apply for my 1301, I have to say where I went to dental school and where I did my residency and that I have BLS, ACLS, PAL, so on, right? So when somebody applies for a 1304, that is filled out for the provider they're bringing in. Then once the board has that, they're essentially a known anesthesia provider providing, anesthesia in dental offices. And that's the only people that this section would apply to. The new,
is that that NAPA form? I'm sorry to interrupt, but that's the NAPA.
That is correct.
Okay. Ollie, go ahead. We got several hands up.
Just to share a couple thoughts I have regarding the temporary to what Dr. Beanstalk was asking. You know, I'm also of the mind that a dentist anesthesiologist shouldn't, either a dentist anesthesiologist should be able to get a temporary, just like we're doing in here when they're a new grad who completed a 3-year residency in anesthesia, or my personal belief is you shouldn't have an on-site evaluation for a 1301 and or 1304. And I almost think that a dentist anesthesiologist who's a new grad out of a 3-year residency program, they shouldn't have to have an on-site evaluation either. I mean, if we're making it all things being equal, that's just my personal take is you don't need this temporary permit if you don't require an on-site evaluation. But if you require an on-site evaluation, then the temporary is necessary, you know, to improve access to care. And same thing, vice versa, if we're keeping the temporary, then we should be considering having a temporary for dentist anesthesiologists when they get out of school. I heard of one recently that took a year after they graduated from the residency program before they could get an on-site evaluation scheduled and start practicing. So, you know, and the board staff works hard enough. We're putting more and more on the board staff with all these on-site evaluations where, you know, especially in the 1304 where, you know, I know you've got the established people who are going to probably be registering with their respective boards, but still, when you do that on-site evaluation, you don't know who else is going to come in the next time. So,
Dr. Blazing.
Yeah, I was just going to voice my support for the temporary permit, just because I think it would expedite things to take place. You know, that's our biggest complaint is that it takes too long to either get the on-site evaluation. And I would certainly think for a 1304, you don't necessarily need an on-site evaluation. So that's why I would support the idea of a temporary or an expedited process.
Susie.
Thank you. So when they use phraseology like known to the board, someone needs to come in that's known to the board. In the 1301, 1302, 1303, the permit holders are known to the board because we license them. In the 1304, the person that's doing the sedation, we don't license them. We don't know what their training is, and we don't know, we don't have authority over them. And so, and we get verification on our guys as direct source. So now if they're saying, well, there's a temporary application and the CRNA or company can send in, you know, proof that they went to school, is that going to be another application, another direct source verification? Or are we taking their word that the training and everything is up to date and good to go? Because our board doesn't regulate those people. And so, and I'd also like to address the 1 year to get a permit. That gets thrown out a lot, but I've never really, I'm beginning to think it's an urban legend because I've never gotten a name. I've never known of any permit taking over a year. We are charged to protect the public, not to make it easier for any one person to sedate somebody. We're charged to protect the public. And I don't really know how a temporary permit is going to flow. I'd be interested to see how we're going to regulate that or bring that to fruition when we don't regulate the people. And if it's going to be a temporary for a 1304, I wouldn't know why it wouldn't be a temporary for ones, twos, and threes.
Thank you, Susie. Dr. German.
I was just going to mention, you know, the temporary permit is in the context of what Dr. Brady's provided, which makes the assumption that the board would receive through the dental provider, as Dr. Arnell talked about, this credentialing form, or at least this application by the provider. So there would be a lot known about these providers. I also think that oftentimes we throw out comments and we're operating under assumptions that just because a sedation provider is not a dental anesthesiologist or an OMFS provider, there's possibility that they're not capable of providing sedation or anesthesia. You have to remember that they're also certified by state board agencies to provide general anesthesia. And so if we can find a way to allow providers common ground to enter these offices to take care of patients, then that's what we need to be doing. And I think Dr. Brady's proposal, at least the language he used, was very, very good and a very, I think, reasonable starting ground. So as far as the temporary permit is concerned, I'm not against it. I think it is actually very good if time is being held up for whatever reason to get these dentists, a sedation provider into their office to take care of their kids or their patients is important to do. I think the contrast between the 1301, 1302, and 1303 is that this dentist who's seeking the 1304 permit isn't able to provide his or her own sedation. So there's this sense of urgency to get that in.
Thank you, Dr. German. Jessica.
Can you guys hear me?
We can.
Okay. So for those of you who are looking at the shared document, I have put in several questions that I have based on this language, such as, is there an expiration for a temporary Section 1304 permit? If not, then what type of incentive does the dentist have to actually go through with an on-site evaluation to get the regular permit? If the temporary doesn't expire and they don't have to have an on-site evaluation to exercise the temporary permit. I kind of had the same questions I think that some of the other people have brought up, which is, if you're not requiring an on-site evaluation for the temporary permit, then is the on-site evaluation really necessary for the regular permit as well? Further down, once we talk about the established non-dental anesthesia provider, I think I had some of the same concerns and questions that some of the board staff had, which is, what does that mean? It kind of sounds like that should be a defined term. And again, you're not, as a dental board, you're not able to regulate anybody but the dental industry. So when you're looking at a non-dentist anesthesia provider, how are you going to keep track of them? How are you going to keep track of whether they are in good standing? Are you going to rely on the dentist who is employing them to check to make sure that they don't have any issues going on with their own regulatory board? So these are some of the questions that I'm thinking of in terms of rule writing and enforcement when it comes to this type of regulation.
Thank you, Jessica. Ollie.
One thought, the question of expiration came on my mind too, Jessica, and part of, you know, a lot of your questions are in line with mine. One thought that I have an idea on is regarding the established non-dental anesthesia provider. You know, it looks like we are going in a path where the non-dental anesthesia providers will need to register with their respective boards. So maybe the verification, you know, it's like what Susie talked about. We're talking about people that are not regulated by the dental board. Maybe it's that, you know, that line could say they're utilizing a non-dental anesthesia provider that is registered with their respective board for dental anesthesia. Because it looks like that's the way we're probably going, is that, you know, CRNAs and physicians will need to register with their boards and be in good standing to obtain that registration. So maybe that would be the source verification for it.
I mean, this would be a question for Jessica, but I mean, can we write language as Ollie's stating if that's not currently in effect with these other boards?
No, unfortunately not. The problem that you're going to run into there is that now you are requiring a regulated community who you do not regulate to do something with their own regulatory board that the regulatory board does not require or provide or may not even have the statutory authority to regulate or provide.
Yeah, so that makes sense, putting the carriage before the horse. But assuming that moves forward, would that kind of clarify this?
That would have to be something that you would have to bring up possibly with legal counsel, possibly statutory changes. That would be some, because now you're talking about a non-dentist doing something with their own regulatory agency.
Right. It would be a statutory change. That's what I'm talking about.
Yeah. Yeah. That really has nothing to do with the dental board itself. You would have to talk to the regulatory agencies and see if that's something that they have, one, the bandwidth and desire to do.
Dr. Arnell.
So I think this form that we're talking about should be understood. It's not a form to regulate the non-dentist anesthesia provider or even for the dental board to vet them. It's essentially a form that the dentist that's getting the 1304 uses to provide information about the provider. And essentially they vet them themselves by filling out that information. And the form is, for all intents and purposes, just an introduction to the dental board saying, hey, here's this provider. Then if there is an adverse occurrence, it's not that you guys regulate that provider or that you had to take the time to vet and confirm all the credentials. It's just that if there's an adverse occurrence and you say, who is this person? You've had this introduction. And you know who it is. So I guess the purpose of the form is really for the dentist to vet their own provider and give an introduction to the board, right? And then I think as far as a time limit goes for the temporary, I think Ryan said that right now issuing a 1304 has an average of 37 days, right? So why not just make the expiration on the temporary somewhere in that range, say like 45 days or something like that.
Dr. Blazek.
I was just curious if anyone, I mean, I don't know if we're allowed to talk about it here or not, but in particular, so much of what we're talking about, and Ollie alluded to it, is, you know, is issues in 1602. And are we allowed to mention that so that Jessica kind of understands where Ollie is coming from?
I would support that because it harmonizes with a lot of this language in the 1304. And I really made it very, very simple, and I have point of references to other states that address it too. So, you know, we can't predict what 1602 is going to do, but I think it works with 1304. And if we're getting the consensus of our colleagues here from our physician anesthesiologists and our CRNA, it may help with that process as well.
And I think just to be, you know, straightforward about it, there's a real sense of, you know, collegiality here that we're trying to do what's best for everybody and have a resolution. And we've been charged with that by the Senate, I guess I could say, you would say.
Yeah, I see the logic behind it in that these are CRNAs or physician anesthesiologists that are already going into other offices. So it's not as though we're expediting a permit for an individual that currently isn't working in this realm, which there's a distinction then certainly between 1301 and 1302 dentists, permit holders. So I can appreciate where Dr. Brady's coming from with this and understand the support. All right, Dr. Beanstalk, you had your hand up at one point.
I did. You know, if the average turnover time is 37 days, or 45 days, I'm still not understanding what procedures need to be done that quickly that we need to expedite a permit.
That was my thought too when it came up. Jessica?
Sorry, can you guys hear me now?
Yeah.
Okay. So it looks like part of 1602, and I know we're not looking to dissect 1602 right now at this meeting, but it looks like it's trying to get at what this committee was talking about initially and trying to do, which is allowing the non-dental anesthesia providers to provide anesthesia in the dental offices. And I think to the extent that it goes through as is, it's absolutely helpful to have the qualified anesthesia provider defined in statute. And I think that that's very useful. But then there are other aspects that if it does go through as is would be somewhat problematic for the direction that you guys have gone in so far. With regard to the non-dental anesthesia provider, particularly because it talks about the anesthesia provider being exclusively responsible for the management of the patient during the procedure, which I think is not the direction that we have talked about with these rules, which kind of puts the onus on the dentist themselves and their staff to make sure that the patient is appropriately monitored during the anesthesia procedure. So for what it's worth, I think that the direction of these rules so far may not be consistent with the direction of 1602.
Thank you, Jessica. Dr. German.
Yeah, thanks. So just, you know, we keep getting hung up on this oversight issue, which I completely understand. And I think it's frustrating for all of us because it's like we're making progress and then all of a sudden we hit the same big wall that's always there. And maybe statutory change is where this is going to end up for better or for worse. But it would be nice to know if there are any legal loopholes. I don't know what effort has been put forth to search out legal loopholes or other options. I think, you know, I work in a hospital and we have many, many providers from different boards, state boards that come in and they practice medicine in the hospital. But the ability to practice medicine in the hospital is overseen by a medical staff And that organization allows and oversees and, you know, implements punitive actions when needed, and, puts hard stops to those providers from practicing medicine in the hospital. It's not any one agency, any one board that does that. It would be nice to know if there's some sort of route we could take to create, for example, an anesthesia oversight committee that could be responsible for anesthesia in dental practices. And they would be responsible for receiving all credentialing applications that could be dentists and non-dentists alike who want to provide anesthesia in dental offices. And they could be responsible for putting the hard stops there, for vetting the applications, for overseeing, you know, these providers. And it sounds like that cannot be a board affiliated committee, but I'm just trying to think outside the box because we keep hitting the exact same wall. And the longer this drags out, this is just going to go to the legislation and become a statutory change, whether we like it or not. So I'm just thinking outside.
And I think they're great points, Dr. German. I worry a little bit that we're getting, you know, off task to an extent from going, you know, trying to finalize these rule edits. I think everybody's on the same page with that would be a nice thing, but, you know, as far as the charge of this committee, I don't know that it's within our purview to accomplish it. Jessica, go ahead, and then I'll go to Ollie.
So I think that it's absolutely possible for the board to specify in its rules that in order for a dentist to employ or work with a non-dental anesthesia provider, they have to do so by doing X, Y, and Z. X, Y, and Z can be that they have to essentially vet their own anesthesia provider and attest to the board that they have done that vetting. And that vetting can be that they have to make sure that they are in fact licensed by whatever regulatory agency needs to be regulating that particular provider, whether it's the nursing board or the medical board or whoever it is. It can be that they have to be in good standing with that regulatory board. It can be that they have to then update the dental board with information on if they change who their provider is going to be, or if some sort of disciplinary action happens with their provider, they have to notify the board, things like that. All of that can be done in rule and be put as the requirement of the dentist in order to work with the anesthesia provider. That is absolutely possible.
I think that meets our objective. So thank you. I mean, basically that's, you're saying the same thing as a temporary permit, but in another way of doing it, because that's what that form does, is exactly what you're saying.
Jessica.
And so.
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
No, please.
I was just going to say, so when you're talking about forms are requirements that you're putting on the public or the regulated community. And so any information, i.e. forms that you're requiring have to be in rule. So when you're requiring a form and you're requiring, you know, a name, you're requiring, you know, a checkbox that they have, you know, completed certain continuing education or that they have been licensed by a particular regulatory agency, all of that needs to be in your rules so that it is a requirement of the dentist to submit that information on the appropriate form.
Ollie.
I was just going to ask Jessica, which, you know, talking back to what Dr. Blazek said of thinking of 1602, I don't know which version you saw, Jessica, because it's now gone through. The oral surgeons gave a lot of input and so did the Dental Association. And the latest version that I saw, I think could jive pretty well with what Dr. Brady put in here, you know, with just a few small adjustments. So I'm just a little, I'm not sure which one it was that you saw where you said that it's really going to make a big change onto the work that we've already put in here onto this section.
I actually pulled up the, I believe it was the Senate engrossed version.
Okay. Yeah, I think there's been amendments since.
Yeah, there's been amendments. Yeah, agreed. Yeah.
And I don't think the amendments are published on AZ Ledge.
Dr. Arnold.
I just wanted to say, you know, I don't want to talk about the content of 1602, but I do want to say I've been heavily involved in following 1602. And in the stakeholders meeting, it was really clear that what happens with 1602 is more based on what we're doing here, right? The message was go back and do your work in the committee and do it really well. And then 1602 doesn't have to be rammed down. It doesn't have to be this like onerous thing rammed down everybody's throat. So although statute trumps rule, they've asked us to do the rule well, and then they'll make the statute match that in essence. That was pretty clear. So I think it is really important for us to do our job here in rule and then create statute that jives with it. Yeah, and it is a dynamic document. There's lots of changes going on right now. It's not finished by any means.
Dr. Brady.
I really like what Jessica was saying. Essentially, if we take that form and we have a consensus on the form, then we can have someone that writes rules way better than any one of us can to put those checkboxes within the 1304, right? Because really that form is putting the onus on the dentist to make sure who they are hiring. And just like Jessica said, that's a fast way to fast track it, is it's on the onus to test that who they are working with has been through this process. So I think it goes to Jermaine's point of how can we actually put this into rules right now and make it work. I see that as a viable option.
So Jessica, what's the best way to mesh the edits Dr. Brady's made with what would be consistent in rule? I mean, could you and him meet outside of committee, modify these edits, and then present back at the next meeting?
If the board would like me to do that, I would be happy to do so. Essentially, what we're talking about is looking at the language that's provided here in the rule, and then also looking at the language on the form and basically meshing the two and making sure that all the information that the board would want or need is both on the form and in the rule, because the only way that you can enforce the information on the form is if it's in the rule.
And I have a sense it's going to be more efficient to try to do it that way rather than flushing this out in committee. But you know, that's not my decision to make. I want to hear from the rest of the committee.
I'm happy with it.
And most importantly, you, Dr. Brady, because I'm volunteering your time.
That's okay.
Yeah, I would think that's, I'd be willing, to make a motion in that regard if that's what's needed, Dr. Hero, because I think that's what you're right on, having an expert like Jessica put it in writing as it needs to be with some input from you and Dr. Brady, and I'd be happy to volunteer my services too if you need it. But, I would make the motion that, yeah, we table this topic of discussion until there's been an opportunity to review outside committee and put down appropriate details and return to committee.
I think that's a great idea.
Is that a second, Dr. Arno?
I second.
Yes.
Okay, Dr. Lott, thank you. We have a motion and a second. Let's get a roll call, please, Sherry. Or Yasmin.
Sorry. All right. Hero.
I'm ready.
Yes.
Hero.
Yes.
Arnell.
Yes.
Bagai?
Yes.
Beanstalk?
Yes.
Brady?
Yes.
Christensen?
Yes.
Jermaine?
Yes.
Lout?
Yes.
Snell?
Yes.
Thank you.
You forgot me. Okay.
Oh, sorry, Dr. Blazek. Dr. Blazek.
I'm a yes.
Yes, right?
This is Dr. Brownstein's here as well.
Great. Welcome, Dr. Brownstein.
I've been here for the whole meeting. Sorry.
Okay, thank you for letting me know.
I just want to say thanks to Dr. Brady. I know he's put in a lot of hours outside of this committee and I think has really brought a lot of, you know, very, very good information and productive information to this committee. So thanks, Jason, for all you do.
Absolutely. Thanks so much.
Oh, thank you, guys. Appreciate it. Is it okay if we just go through a little bit of the other red lines just to kind of circle our heads while we work outside?
Yeah, for sure. Absolutely.
I don't think there's too much point.
Okay, so it sounds like I will discuss the subsection D and the temporary and the form issues outside of the committee, and that'll bring us down to the new subsection E, which would be the section 1304 permit holder shall keep an anesthesia or sedation record for each general anesthesia and sedation procedure that meet the requirements specified in 1301E.
No argument there.
Okay. Then we'll keep moving along. Brings us to the new H, which is the section 1304 permit holder must ensure that the non-dentist anesthesia provider meets or exceeds the non-educational requirements and restrictions of a section 1301 permit holder.
Ali.
Can we just talk about section G before we talk about the new section H?
Sure.
I think it would be beneficial that the dentist who holds the permit can delegate the responsibility of the patient to whatever anesthesia provider he or she is bringing in. So I'm not sure the best way to wordsmith that section G, but that piece is putting, you know, the responsibility of to do something that these guys aren't really trained in any significant way to do on them to take care of the patient. And it should be the, you know, non-dentist anesthesia provider that comes in that should be responsible for what's in section G. And I know the dental board can't be responsible for regulating, right, that dentist, non-dentist anesthesia provider. But I think the dental board could probably say it's okay for the dentist to allow that non-dentist anesthesia provider to be responsible for these items.
Dr. Blazek.
Yeah, I would agree with Ali on that one. You know, that shouldn't be up to the dentist. And I don't know why we just can't change that wording to, you know, the section 1304 permit holder shall ensure that the patient is supervised, you know, by the anesthesia provider or something of that nature. And I think, again, that'd be consistent with the way 1602 is going to roll out, which is there's, you know, it's like the onus on a 1301 permit holder. We're responsible to recover the patient.
All right, Dr. Snell.
Back up in section A of this, A2, says the dentist permit holder shall provide all dental treatment and ensure that the non-dental anesthesia provider remains on the dental, in the dental office. Should probably change that from on to in. in the dental office or dental clinic premises until any patient receiving anesthesia sedation services is discharged. Is that a spot where we can just add that in there? I mean, it's I know it's just on the premises. We're talking about being with the patient, but to consolidate stuff and make it just take out section G and add in that the dentist, the permit holder, ensures that the non-dental anesthesia provider remains with the patient until they're ready for discharge.
Raleigh.
The way that I see A2, Dr. Snell, is, you know, more of just being present, right? Where this section, G is more talking about responsibility.
Yeah, I 100% agree. That's the way I read it as well. So I'm just suggesting remove G and just put being responsible in A2. Or we can just do what Randy said and put it, keep G and just switch it to.
Oh, you're thinking how to make it less wordy.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Well, and, you know, part of what this is, I think, trying to accomplish is in a multi-dentist practice, you know, if you have one person that has a 1304 permit and then another dentist doing the treatment that does not have that permit, you know, who's kind of responsible? And does every dentist in that multi-dental practice require a 1304 permit? So, and I like the way it's worded at the beginning there, because it does prevent a non-permanent dentist from working with a non-dentist anesthesia provider under some other dentist's 1304 permit. So which can get a little ambiguous if we're adjudicating a case. Dr. Snell.
Dr. I hadn't even thought of it. I didn't know that was a possibility. So you're saying that in a multi-dentist office, there's one, Dr. A has a 1304 permit, Dr. B does not, but Dr. B is allowed to do?
No. I think this is specifically saying that Dr. B is not allowed to do the treatment.
You have to have a permit, the 1304. It's not by facility, it's by individual doctor, right?
Correct.
The permit.
Correct.
Well, I'm all for changing the wording in G.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to, that's what I was just saying. If you don't like going back and switching two, then just switch G and keep it more words to it. That's fine. Just switch it so it's not the permit holder, it's the anesthesia provider.
Yeah, right.
It makes more sense that way too.
Ali.
Just, you know, thinking of what you brought up, Dr. Hero, with the, you know, multi-dentist office that's bringing in a non-dentist anesthesia provider, why shouldn't the permit holder be able to do a different case while the physician anesthesiologist or CRNA is in there if a dentist anesthesiologist can go in an office that doesn't have any permit at all?
Well, I mean, it's something we can talk through. I just wanted to clarify, you know, why that language was written the way it was.
I think it's because the dental board requires that there be a dentist with a permit, right? So when you're a dentist anesthesiologist or an oral surgeon, you hold the permit. And the purpose of the 1304 is to make it so that a non-dental anesthesia provider can easily adapt into the dental environment, and that 1304 has to be tied to somebody's license, right? Some dentist's license. I think it's good to tie it to a dentist, because what's to prevent something like, you know, a multi-doc practice where one doc gets a 1304 and, you know, several dentists come in and out, and over time, there's no, like, the whole purpose of the 1304 is lost when it's just handed down from one to the next to the next to the next. I think the whole purpose of the 1304 is to make an easy adapter for nursing and dentistry to come together, or medicine and dentistry to come together. And, but it, that adapter has to be tied to a provider, right? To a dentist.
Yeah. I mean, all I'm saying in this moment is regarding, you know, let's say the person who holds the permit owns the practice and they have 3-4 other dentists. They're doing business work for the business, administrative type work. So they can easily hop up from their desk and be an extra set of hands for any issue that arises. Oh gosh, what if they're even just doing an exam next door that they could easily hop up and go to the room where one of their associates is doing a procedure with anesthesia. It just seems a little redundant if you have a practice with, say, 5 dentists, that all 5 dentists need to get a permit to bring in a non-dentist anesthesia provider, when that same office, none of the dentists could get a permit and they can bring in a dentist anesthesiologist.
I think that unfortunately goes back to the age-old issue Dr. Germain brought up, which is about regulation. And the dental board has the ability to regulate the dental anesthesiologist, and it has the ability to regulate the dentist, but we do not have the ability to regulate the CRNA or the MDA. I think that's kind of the basic reason why that happens.
Yeah, I think we need to have a dentist with a permit working. If a dentist is working on an anesthesia case or sedation case, dentist has to be permitted. That's in the room. And Ollie, what you just described is my practice, right? We have 7 different dentists, each in different specialties, working in my office. Several of them have no sedation experience. And when my dad was providing our anesthesia, who was a physician anesthesiologist, I made sure they all had 1304 permits. And it was not a big deal. It was smooth. It was quick. So I think, you know, the argument against it, from at least personal experience, which may be anecdotal, but it's experience nonetheless, it was a non-issue to make sure they were permitted, and it was safer because they were more prepared as well. Go ahead, Dr. Brady.
And I think the whole objective, too, is we're trying to reduce latency as possibly as we can. So hopefully that kind of helps with those concerns.
Yeah, I think everybody's doing the best they can to make it as reasonable as possible and still have it function in a regulated environment.
Yeah, I think as long as the board decides to oversee practices within dental offices, there's going to be these, you know, minute discrepancies that are going to occur. And I don't know if we're going to be able to do anything until or if the board ever decides not to oversee these things. That's probably why the medical board pulled out of oversight and physician offices, and there's other agencies that oversee practices and sedation in those offices.
Okay, the dental board takes on a lot for us to have these privileges, that's for sure.
Okay, Jessica, you want to keep us moving?
Sure. So in listening to the discussion, I changed a couple of things here in G, because, again, going on, you know, the premise that you can't really regulate the non-dental folks, essentially what you're saying is you want to make sure that the permit holder is making sure that the one who's providing anesthesia is continuously supervising the patient until the patient reaches the point where they can be discharged or is in the recovery state and meets those particular guidelines. So I've essentially put that in the rule that if the 1304 permit holder shall ensure the non-dentist anesthesia provider continuously supervises the patient. And again, it is the 1304 permit holder who is ensuring that the non-dentist anesthesia provider does not commence additional procedures until they're current patient is in the monitored recovery.
And that's great.
I think it reads well. It's good. Move on.
Good.
Okay.
Yeah. That brings us, good.
That brings us then to H, which is section 1304 permit holder must ensure that the non-dentist anesthesia provider meets or exceeds the non-educational requirements and restrictions of a section 1301 permit holder.
Perfect.
What's meets the non-educational requirements?
Yeah, I get what you're saying. Is there a section it should reference?
Well, it's basically saying all the staffing, equipment, everything that goes into a section 01, a 1301 permit, that standard is held. It's kind of more like an umbrella term that's saying, look at 1301. That's what that permit holder must ensure happens.
I think it's great, man. You did such a good job with this, Jason.
Yeah, I agree. Really well.
Agreed.
Done. Yeah, it looks great.
Thank you. There is one other section once we get past H, and it just goes to reporting. I know it's outside of the 1304, but.
No, Jason, I was going to bring it up too. I mean, as long as we're on reports of adverse occurrences, maybe we can modify the, or at least have the discussion about the time frame to report if we want to tighten that up a little bit. Jessica?
Hey, Anthony?
Yeah.
Dr. Earle, just a real quick one here. I think this is, you know, something for you, because I know you have some requirements after this meeting, but I think it's safe to say, from my perspective, we've tightened up 1304 quite nicely, other than how do we incorporate that form. I think this is a huge step in the right direction in terms of what our charge is in terms of getting this finished. So I personally would walk away feeling pretty good about that.
Yeah, I think it's great. In fact, when we get to the next meeting on the 21st, we originally had talked about an all-day meeting. I don't think we need that. But Jessica, you've got your hand up.
Yeah. So I'm a little, now granted, I haven't parsed through all of 1301 in light of this new subsection H in 1304. But on first blush, it makes me a little nervous, to say that the permit holder must ensure that the non-dentist anesthesia provider meets or exceeds the non-educational requirements and restrictions of a section 1301 permit holder.
Maybe I can give you the objective and we can kind of figure it out backwards. So the objective for this is, like, let's say we have a non-permitted anesthesia provider and they've been out of practice for X amount of years, or, you know, they want to come back and do anesthesia. Well, as a dentist, we have to make sure, okay, what are the anesthesia that we're doing? Are we doing it on kids? If so, they need to meet or exceed the pediatric requirements on currency for kids. Are they doing it on adults? Okay. Well, what are our requirements for that? If we add in there that thing that we earmarked about, you know, the dentists that do low numbers of cases as well. It's just basically trying to put, and maybe there's a better way to say all of that, like the PEDS endorsements and all the requirements for everything. That's what I mean in the non-CE requirements, not like the CE of them having to do 50 hours of CE or whatever else we put in there, sit in a lecture hall, but actually the equipment, the staffing, the currency, the age restrictions, all of those standards, the dentist, the permit holder must make sure that they're working in those parameters. They're not going outside of those parameters of their capabilities. I mean, they may have a very capable anesthesia provider, yeah. So, but they're responsible to make sure that what their capabilities are. So if there's a way to clean up age, that's not so ambiguous. I would love some help on that.
It seems to me the whole point is just to say what's required in 1301 is required for the non-dentist anesthesia provider, except for the continuing education requirements that are specific to dentists, right?
That's correct.
So the concern that I have there, which I totally follow what you're trying to do, the concern I have is that when you go to 1301, that's actually for a dental professional. And so everything in that rule refers to the dentist, and it doesn't refer to a non-dentist anesthesia provider. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that when you're talking about, we'll just use the pediatrics, for example, when it's talking about what you have to do in order to get a pediatric endorsement for a 1301 permit, it talks about the PALS, but then it also talks about having completed a CODA-accredited residency program that includes a standard for pediatric anesthesia training within 2 years immediately preceding the dentist application for pediatric endorsement. You're also going to run into the problem of trying to have that apply to a non-dentist anesthesia provider.
We need to tease out exactly what is the highlights then of the 1301 and just respell it out in H.
And I think 1301 itself needs to be cleaned up quite a bit too before it's final. Just throwing that out there.
Dr. Blazek.
Well, with all due respect, I think 1301 is cleaned up. We did that once. And the other thing I would say is, why can't we just actually delete Section H? Does it really have to be there?
The only question I have is if someone, and I have to go back through it, but I mean, what if this non-permanent anesthesia provider has never worked on kids, and now they have someone that wants to go and do a whole bunch of general anesthesia on kids because they can't do dentistry on kids?
I hear what you're saying, but I think that's up to the anesthesia provider to own that and say, you know what, you need to have a pediatric designation. I see what you're saying now. I guess you can't. Yeah.
I mean, the only thing to really do is to maybe put other limitations on the 1304 provider, on the 1304 permit holder. I don't know. But there's got to be somewhere in that 1304.
Yeah, that includes the problem of, you know, the limitations we have on a 1301, 2, and 3 with the P designation, you know, have to be so many cases, X, Y, Z. It doesn't speak to the non-dental anesthesia provider that's coming in, right? So you could have a general dentist that does pediatrics quite often but only does anesthesia on pediatrics, a handful of times a year. But the person they're bringing in happens to be a pediatric fellowship trained physician anesthesiologist, right? So that's kind of where it gets a little. So yeah, I see what you're, I totally get what you're trying to do here, Dr. Perry. I think it makes sense. It's just how to tease it out the right way so it's clear.
Maybe you can do that.
Can we not have a 1304P designation?
Well, that's what I'm saying. If part of the P designation, that's on the dentist, right? So, you can have a general dentist peds, right? But he only does a peds sedation case or anesthetic case, five times a year maybe, or maybe even less. But he's doing sedation more than that with people over 8. But you're bringing in a non-dentist anesthesia provider that all they do is pediatric anesthesia. So now you're limiting that practice.
So the onus... Well, the onus would be on the 1304P permit holder to ensure that that non-dentist anesthesia provider has the currency to do the pediatric cases.
Yeah, and that's exactly what I'm trying to accomplish.
Yes.
Yeah.
Jessica.
Yeah, I think you guys were hitting the nail on the head there. I think you probably do want to have, just like we did with the other permits, have some sort of pediatric endorsement or a 1304 permit holder. And essentially what their requirements are going to be will be to ensure that whatever non-dentist anesthesia provider they work with or employ has X, Y, and Z credentials, training, education, whatever it is that you think that they need in order to provide that anesthesia service to a pediatric patient.
Yeah, that's good. Yep.
I think that works because it's doing the same objective.
So for the next meeting, what as far as this 1304 language goes, we'd want to focus in on that temporary permit and then a 1304P designation. That sound right? Dr. Lout?
Yeah, I was just wondering if we want to put the P explanation underneath H or do we want to put it somewhere else?
Jessica, do you have a opinion on that?
I do not. I'd be happy to, when I'm going through the rules, either on my own before the next meeting or with Dr. Brady, to look at where it might fit best. But H, I mean, as a placeholder for now, doesn't seem to be too bad.
No, I think it's a good place to put it. That's my opinion.
And then if we could go to the AO section.
Yeah, the 1305.
But then, Anthony, I don't know after this if I don't know if we go to executive
session
or just a quick moment, just sure. Because I wanted to express some opinions that may help with our committee about how this intertwines with the potential of the 1602 that may or may not even be appropriate. Here. So it kind of gives us a little bit of, I don't even know if we can get into the executive session or not.
Well, so, and Rob, are you still on with us?
Yes, I am.
So for executive session, my understanding is we typically go to executive session if there's a legal question or to discuss confidential information.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, if it's a legal question or if there's confidential information that needs to be discussed, you can go to executive session.
Okay.
You can do that if that's so what the board members desire.
Okay. Well, it's more of just having a discussion. I really don't have to go into executive session. I just want to have a very quick discussion about 1602.
Okay, and we're agendized for that, so I think we're okay, okay. To do that in open session.
Okay.
So this part of it is just the reporting of to all the boards, essentially.
Okay. If you're going to go to executive session, you need to have some sort of vote to get into executive session. And then if I remember correctly, you need to stop the recording for the public and then have another recording or writing of what occurs in executive session.
Yes, normally we would, there would be a separate room or a separate virtual room we go into. But Dr. Brady, it sounds like we may not need to do that.
No, we don't. I didn't know that we had that as an agenda.
Okay, so go ahead.
Was there any more discussion on that revision for that 1305? And I want to get Ali's opinion if that jives with him.
Yeah, I think it looks good, Jason.
Did we want to change the amount of days required to report?
I mean, I guess depending on what happens with 1602, that may change to 3 business days instead of 10 days. But I think it's the same things that have come up a couple other times on this meeting of putting the carriage before the horse, right?
Was the last version of 1602 3 days if there's a death or 3 days for any adverse occurrence?
Let me look.
I thought it was a death
or if EMS is activated.
I thought it was if EMS was activated.
And Dr. Blazek, this would be the opportunity to work in that language regarding, you know, kind of broadening the definition of what's being reported.
Right. So, emergency medical response occurs in a dental office or dental clinic during the administration of dental care or recovery from general anesthesia, deep sedation, moderate sedation, or minimal sedation. The anesthesia provider or dentist or anesthesia should be involved. Yeah, I just think we add that in there. To include the administration of dentistry.
So regardless if the patient is sedated or not.
Right.
Is that clear for you, Jessica?
Yes. So it sounds like you guys want this to apply to the administration of dental services or recovery. It's basically any dental services that are being provided in the dental office or the dental clinic.
Whether they're sedated or not.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
What if a patient or a parent grandparent has an episode?
They're not getting dentistry. They're sitting in the waiting room.
Right. So we're not including that?
You didn't provide care.
Just making it clear.
Yeah.
Dr. Arnell?
I was just going to say, maybe 10 days is a little bit long. I think 3 days is pretty short, too. I mean, all of us tend to, I think it's human nature to tend to think that something bad happened and definitely somebody is to blame, especially in our culture. But I think a lot, you know, sometimes these things happen and there's really nobody to blame, and it can be a monumental event in this professional's life. And whether it takes 3 days or 10 days to get it reported, probably, you know, it won't affect the health or safety of that patient. The event is over, right? I would lean toward giving any professional a little bit more than 3 days to gather their thoughts and pull themselves together and make a good report.
Yeah, so I do think it's important to remember, you know, the purpose is to protect the public, you know, not the provider, really. I mean,
okay.
But with that said, there needs to be, you know, a fair amount of time for them to report. But I think 10 days is too long. Again, if a provider is a threat to the public, the board needs an opportunity to respond and adjudicate, you know, quickly. Jessica, you had your hand up, and then I'll go to you, Dr. Blazek.
Sorry, I'm trying to wordsmith as you guys are talking, because I actually think that Dr. Beanstalk made a good point. The way that this was written, if you're not specifying that it's the death of the patient or an incident that happens with the patient, then technically this could apply to the mother or the grandmother or, you know, whoever's there, technically, I guess, being required to report that they had a heart attack in the waiting room. So really we're talking about if it's the death of the patient or an incident requiring emergency medical response for the patient that occurs in a dental office or dental clinic during the administration or the recovery of dental services, or general anesthesia, deep sedation, moderate sedation, or minimal sedation, the anesthesia provider and treating dentist involved shall submit a complete report. So I just wanted to clarify that that's what you guys are trying to get at. It's really an incident that's happening with the patient, not anybody who just happens to be there.
Well, and Jessica, just to make things more difficult, what if the mom in the waiting room is also a patient. Do we need to, you know, modify that language? And I'm not trying to be a pain in the ass, but, you know, should it read like if the death of the patient receiving dental services or something like that, so it's a little more honed in? Dr. Blazek, you had your hand up.
Yeah, I was only going to comment about the 10-day thing in that, yeah, three is short, maybe five is the right number. But I think it's important that the board puts an emphasis on the report of the adverse occurrence in a timely fashion, as well as what the staff put together, the board having a formal addressing of the adverse occurrence in a timely fashion. So that's why it's, I think, good that we push this to get it done quickly, the reporting.
And the dentist does have to have an opportunity to report it to liability insurance and hire an attorney if they want. So I'm wondering, too, if this could be written where if it is 3 days, it's reported in 3 days. Maybe it's reported in a way that it's not all the information, but just this happened, something very succinct with the records and more robust information to follow. But I don't know if that's going to complicate the rules and, frankly, the board. Dr. Brady, you had your hand up, and then Dr. Germain, and then Ollie.
Yeah, I mean, it's like those little nuances. I'm not sure what you're going to capture in 3 days that you wouldn't capture in 10 days that make actionable things from the board to a provider. That's either, you know, unless there's like perjury or other concerns involved with that. I'm not quite sure. The differences of from the board's, lens. The other thing, I mean, if it's 5 days, 3 days, so be it, but it just seems like I'm not quite sure what the difference is. And it may be like the provider ability to have like a more comprehensive report to you. So one way or the other. The other thing that I'm looking at here, we teach this a lot in simulation, is that we don't want any provider to be hesitant to activate EMS services at all. You know, I always tell everyone it's never wrong to call 911. And so it may be a little bit punitive if it's just emergency medical response. Let's say that same patient, you had EMS come and the patient now is like either like in a recoverable spot or they, you know, they had a seizure after sedation and it was in recovery, or they had a slew of different things where maybe you're just going to be extra precautionary because maybe they aspirated a little bit, you know, and you want them to go get evaluated at the hospital. I think more of a better reporting trigger might be something like admit it to the hospital within 24 hours or something of that type of language. That's all. I mean, I'm just showing the devil's advocacy, because I think there's problems where providers are like hesitant to activate EMS, even though it's the right thing for them to do. They have this thing, and oh my gosh, now I'm going to report to the board. What does that mean? And they have these biases that play into them. Where if we're looking at an adverse event, it's either going to happen or not, but it's not a hesitation for them to activate EMS. But I get the whole why we report and wanting that information. It's just my personal thing that it could be cleaned up a little bit to be like, admitted to the hospital within 24 hours or something like that.
Dr. Germain.
Yeah, I agree, Jason. It brings a whole different dynamic to psychology, I think, when you have these mandates. But then again, I think we're all used to the need to report, you know, adverse occurrences. You know, Dr. Hero, I agree that an immediate response to an adverse occurrence is I think beneficial. I mean, if it's something where a patient went to the hospital because of monitoring purposes after a medication, that's one thing. But if there was CPR performed, or heaven forbid there was a death or something like that, the board would want to know about that immediately, because that would imply different actions that could, you know, potentially affect patient safety in the ensuing days thereafter. But the reporting mechanism, I think, is also very important. I know that as a physician, we have very spelled out adverse occurrences that we can just check off and submit immediately when that occurs. That does not include a formal write-up. It's just a checkbox that's to happen, and then it gets submitted the day of the event. It's very seamless. It's very easy to kind of watch. But I agree, this is interesting to kind of tease out and figure out how best to do this and not, you know, kind of come across as a punitive effort.
Well, and to kind of put it into perspective, we've had cases where there was an adverse occurrence resulting in a death, and it was working its way through social media and eventually the news before it was reported to the board. So board's getting calls.
You don't want that.
Yeah. So now what's that balance? Is 10 days too much? Is 3 days too few? I don't know, but it's appropriate we're having a conversation. Dr. Christensen, I'm going to you. I know you were not the next up, but you haven't spoken yet.
I know I agree with Dr. Brady, and I've talked to Dr. Blazek about this too, and I think I've mentioned it a few times with Dr. Hero that I think it should be if a patient's admitted, then it requires a report to the board. I think it keeps people with the idea they can call, they can reach out just to as a precautionary. I think it would feel less punitive, but also maintain, maybe even increase safety in some aspects if they feel like they can call just to be extra safe. And then if the patient requires an admission, then they can report that. Thank you.
Thank you. Jessica.
So I have a couple of questions/comments, maybe suggestions. Because again, we can't regulate the non-dental folks. So if you're talking about a non-dentist anesthesia provider, you can't require them to do anything. What you can do is you can require your regulated people to do something. So in this case, you can require the permit holder to submit a complete report of the incident to you as the dental board. And if it involves a non-dentist anesthesia provider, you can, again, require the permit holder to submit some sort of report to whoever regulates the non-dentist, whether it's the medical board or the nursing board or whoever it is.
Okay.
So my question, I guess, here is when it's talking about, I think the original suggestion was the anesthesia provider and the treating dentist involved shall submit a complete report to the dental board. I don't think you can require the anesthesia provider to do that, but you can require the dentist and the permit holder to do that. My question, I guess, in this case would be, do you want to report if the permit holder and the treating dentist are different? Do you want two reports on the same incident?
When you say two, you mean one, you mean both to the dental board, or one report to the dental board and one report to the regulatory board of the non-dentist anesthesia provider?
Two reports to the dental board, one from the permit holder who is not the treating dentist.
That's a good question. Ollie, you got your hand up.
Sorry, I was just pondering Jessica's question. So, see, what were you saying? So for the reporting, you mentioned the non-dentist anesthesia provider. In rule, we can make it so that the dentist has to report this to both the dental board and the regulatory body of the non-dentist anesthesia provider.
I think that makes sense. But that wasn't why I had my hand up. But is that what you're saying, Jessica?
Yes, because you can require, yes, because you can require your regulated community to do things, but you cannot require other regulated communities to do things. Correct. So if you want to make sure that the regulating board of the non-dentist is aware of what happened, then you need to require your dentist to make the report to the other regulating board.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. You know, I think that the thinking that Dr. Christensen and others have talked about of, you know, the reporting and not having notifying EMS punitive and trying to change it to just being reported if the patient's admitted makes a lot of sense. You know, because you certainly want people to activate EMS before the patient dies, right? So I think it makes a lot of sense to take away a bit of that punitive aspect of it. Of course, that's going to require follow-up by the dentist to make sure that the patient did or did not get admitted. And I don't know if that would want to be put in rule or just, I mean, make it obvious. You know, I think 3 days does feel pretty quick. I think it's a good progress from where things started, where it was 3 days and your permit to administer anesthesia suspended. So, I think it's pretty good progress. You know, it is business days. So I guess don't have a bad outcome on Monday, Tuesday, or Wednesday. You know, if it's Thursday or Friday, you get a couple of extra days to think about it. But, please know I'm joking, about something that's not really funny. But anyways, I think this makes sense. We want to make sure it's reportable. I don't know what the number is. They go to 5. I think 10 seems too long, like Dr. Hero mentioned. So I guess my question is, what is the complete report of the incident? Is it an email that summarizes what happened? Or is it all the medical records that you have on the patient? You know, so what is it that the dentist and the non-dentist anesthesia provider actually have to get together to qualify as a complete report of the incident? Because I think that does weigh in on the time, right? If it's an email, hey, I want to report what happened in my office. I had this patient, date of birth, XYZ. Here's what I was doing. Here's what happened. And, you know, it's 3 paragraphs in an email. 3 days really isn't a big deal. If it's, you got to gather all the treatment records and medical history and, you know, all that, 3 days becomes a little more challenging, right? So.
So I believe it's, and Susie, jump in and correct me, but there's an online adverse occurrence form that's filled out where you just basically write up what happens. And I think after that, your records are subpoenaed and you have 30 days to submit those. Is that right, Susie?
That's the way that it stands currently. There is some chatter about having the records be attached to the adverse occurrence report, but currently they do the report and then we subpoena the records.
Thank you.
And what's in the new policy that we looked at today? Is it that along the same lines of that, of it's just kind of a narrative?
It's pretty much along the same lines as that, yes.
Okay. I mean, given that, 3 business days, I think, seems okay. But.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, I'm comfortable with 5. I mean, depending on what the rest of the committee thinks. Sometimes 3, I think. I think it's a rush at that point. I mean, if you got to call your insurance or you want to speak to an attorney, even if it's just to fill out this initial form, 5 is a little more palatable to me. I do like the idea of changing the definition to only include death or a hospital admission. I think that makes sense.
So if you change an emergency medical response to just say admission to a hospital.
Or death.
Yeah, so that first line, Jessica, if a death of the patient receiving dental services or admission to the hospital, something like that.
Yeah, after where it says emergency medical response, just change that to admission to a hospital.
Should we set a time frame of 24 hours or anything like that?
Yeah.
Well, what about red or incident requiring emergency medical response that resulted in a hospital admission?
That works.
That's real clear then. So, I mean, if you had to call 911 and they transported to the hospital, you report that. If the patient was discharged and ended up going to the hospital the next day, you know, then it's not a reportable occurrence.
This is Jeff Brownstein. What if they go home and have a complication and then have to go to the hospital and be admitted?
Well, then they were admitted.
Yeah, I think that that's a reportable. You know, I just got consult on a case exactly like that. In the hospital. So if the dentist is aware, they should report it, I think.
If they go home, so if they're discharged, but end up in the hospital, so then what's our time frame?
24 hours.
24 hours, I think, is reasonable.
Okay. Yeah.
Jessica?
Okay, so I think I'm hearing consensus on that the emergency has to be within 24 hours. And it sounds like we're looking at admission to the hospital. I guess my question here is, what if it requires an emergency room visit that does not result in admission to the hospital?
You don't have to report it.
Okay.
I think this is going to – we run the risk of this being confusing. So people aren't going to know what they need to report and what they don't. I agree with where we're headed with it. But, Jessica, I think we just, you know, as you always do, I mean, let's try to be very clear so there's – try to minimize the confusion. Dr. Arnau, I'm sorry. I know you've had your hand up for a bit.
I had my hand up for a bunch of things, but a bunch of them were resolved except for one thing. And you kind of brought it up, Dr. Hero, you suggested that it be, a transport that results in an admission. And I think that's because of the nuance of what it is right now, right? Like if you discharge a patient, and they meet all discharge criteria and then they go home and then they have some kind of something that they end up going to the hospital for, right now that's not a reportable, it's not a reportable occurrence because they were discharged in good condition, right? This would change it. So now if you discharge a patient in good condition and they meet all the discharge criteria and then they go home and they have trouble and get admitted, then it's kind of adding a reporting requirement. And I liked your suggestion, Dr. Hero, that it be a transport that results in an admission or a death, because all that other stuff is completely outside of our control.
And knowing about it is outside the dentist's control. I mean, if the patient's meets discharge requirements, goes home, goes to the hospital the next day on their own accord, how's the licensee supposed to know about it? And how's the board supposed to verify that the licensee knew about it if we find out about it? You know, I mean, I worry that this becomes difficult to enforce.
Yeah, I think it's really wise and will eliminate tons of gray area if it says a transport that results in an admission or a death, because otherwise there's no way, like you said, for anyone to know. And you know, a lot of things are completely outside of our control. We tell the patient to stay well hydrated afterwards. They go home and don't eat or drink anything at all for 24 hours and go in dehydrated and get admitted to get, you know, to be observed while they rehydrate. That's not the fault of the anesthesia provider. You know, and there's like a million other scenarios, you know.
Right.
You tell them, don't take five, you know, they go to an oral surgery practice, don't take five Percocet. They go home and take five Percocet and end up admitted to the hospital. That's not something that the oral surgeon could ever control and shouldn't be held responsible for.
All right, Jessica.
So I did want to clarify that you also have this language occurs in a dental office or dental clinic. So if they go home and something happens, that doesn't really meet what's in this rule currently, because the incident or the death did not occur in the dental office or the dental clinic during the administration or recovery from the dental services.
Dr. Snow.
I like where this is headed. It's great. Referencing what Ali questioned with the complete report email, there's nothing in here that provides direction that there's some online document that the provider needs to complete. Should there be something here? Like if I were to read this, hey, I need to submit a complete report to the board. That's totally up to my interpretation. That's how I deem that as the provider. So I'm going to simply send an email and say, hey, I saw a patient today and he passed away in the chair. And that's my reporting because that's an official report that I'm giving as it states in here. Is that sufficient? And then the board would come back and say, okay, thanks for letting us know. Here's the online form. Go here, fill it out and complete it and send it to us. And that needs to be done in this whatever 3, 5, 10 day time frame, or should there something in these rules that should, I don't know that the link is the right word, but direct the individual to an online form that could be found at the dental board website or something like that.
I mean, normally they, you know, you would know either to go online or you'd call the board, and staff would direct you to the online form to report the occurrences.
Is it the form that needs to be submitted within the
initially it's the form, and then all the records are subpoenaed, and the licensee would get a letter from the board explaining that as well.
So if something happens, let's just say it's a 3 days that I need to report. If something happens today and I submit tomorrow's one, Thursday's two, I submit it on Friday, just an email, because I interpret that to be my official report. And then I get an email back from the board saying, oh, you need to fill out this form and it needs to be done by the end of today because this is the third day. I just think that should be a little more in this rule descriptive of what does that official complete report entail? For the sake of the provider.
What the complete report is.
Yeah, it's an online form. You can find it on the board website. Just something that points in. Because if I wait 3 days, I think I'm doing what I'm supposed to. Because I'm filling a complete report by sending in this email. Even if I do like a really complete report and I submit everything, all my records, everything via certified mail to the board. And I do that on day three. What their definition of a complete report is filling out that online form. And there's nothing in here that shows that there's any online form that I'm supposed to do for an adverse occurrence. How am I supposed to know that? And so I'm going to be penalized for that.
My other question is, I mean, if this is, and Jessica, I'll ask you this. You know, there's a chance that the bill 1602 is going to define some of this in statute. Should we wait to make all these edits until we see what happens with that, or just make our edits and then
if it conflicts with the statute that passes, adjusted at that point.
So I would continue making your edits the best that you can, the way that you would like to see them in rule, whether or not 1602 passes, because if 1602 passes, whether it's in its current form or if it's amended further, it's going to pass much sooner than you guys are going to complete these rules through the rulemaking process. And so if it passes in whatever form it passes, you can then change these rules to match whatever comes out of 1602.
Okay. Dr. Brady.
So the reason I like the 24 hours, or if the onus is if the provider is aware of an admission to the hospitals, because we've reviewed cases where they're clearly over-sedated, discharged way too soon, and they go home and they obstruct. So I don't think you're out of the woods just because you got them out of the office, right? So I figured that 24-hour window there, if they know, then the right thing for them to do is to report, right? So I think if they don't know, they don't know. I mean, you can't help what you don't know. But at the same time, some event like that, you probably, the provider is going to know.
Dr. Arnell.
I'm sorry to come back to this, but I do remember the other thing I wanted to mention. You know, if you just think about the nuts and bolts of what happens after an adverse occurrence, that provider, adverse occurrence gathers their thoughts, calls their insurance carrier. The insurance carrier is actually who assigns them the attorney. That may take two days to assign the attorney. Then they have to get in contact with their attorney. That's going to take a day. The provider and the attorney may not know the rules. They're going to have to read up on the rules. I think 3 days is going to be an impossibility for a lot of people. I mean, it's going to be I think what'll happen is if it says 3 days, there's going to be tons of people who are punished. They're trying to do the right thing, but they can't get it done fast enough. It's just going to be like all these people getting punished for a 3-day window.
Susie.
Hi, this is Sherry. I just want to remind the committee members, the messages that you put in chat are not gathered for the minutes and the audio. So if you have something, it would be more beneficial to please continue to raise your hand and verbally include that. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Sherry. Ali.
Thanks for pointing that out, Susie. So I think most people saw what I put in the chat, so I'll just add it. Regarding kind of the confusion of people being made aware, the 24-hour window, differentiating the death for activating EMS, the admission. So one thing that I was suggesting to start that 1305 section would be to say if the death of the patient receiving dental services occurs in a dental office or dental clinic during the administration of or recovery from dental services or from general anesthesia, deep sedation, moderate sedation, or minimal sedation, or the permit holder is made aware of a hospital admission within 24 hours of the dental services, I suppose it could also add and or anesthesia services, the permit holder and the treating dentist involved shall submit a complete report of the incident, and then as it goes on there. It goes back to what we've all been talking about with EMS. You know, Dr. Snell mentioned the 24-hour window, and it takes into account that the dentist becomes aware because, like you guys have said, the patient could leave and then go check themselves in and never tell the dentist. 24 hours in anesthesia is kind of the out of the woods generally of complications being related to anesthesia to some degree. No, Dr. German?
Well, I'm just, I think you're right to some degree. To some degree, but I think, you know, there's perioperative heart attacks, for example. I mean, there's the perioperative stuff that does occur within 24, 48 hours even, that can be tied back to anesthesia. So I definitely agree with the 24-hour window, in my opinion.
So I put that in the text and we were having some discussion. So I just wanted to verbalize it for the minutes so that, just to put it there.
Ollie, I do like the way you articulated that though.
Cause it kind of,
I liked what Ollie wrote and I thought that was pretty good. That's why my comment to him on the chat was like, hey, that's pretty good. I didn't know it wasn't being seen. Yes.
I saw it. Thanks, Dr. Pleasant.
Dr. Brady.
Yeah, I like it too. I think you could even just say any level of sedation or general anesthesia, just to kind of whatever that is. And is 1305 the only place of reports of adverse occurrences? Dentals don't have it shown, right? They lost an object, tip, someone has a lost object, passed through to, there's other things in place in the rules. Am I correct in saying that? Is this 1305 really just for anesthesia, sedation?
Can anyone on board staff answer that? While we're waiting on that, go ahead, Dr. Snow.
It is currently for sedation. It's currently for sedation incidents.
So I was just going to say, if it stays that way, then that negates what I'm about to say. But what the way that it was proposing to be changed was that it's for any dental service. So while the 24-hour thing makes sense for anesthesia stuff, what if you got I just did a filling on a kid, everything's fine, and he drives home, gets in a car accident, goes to the hospital, that's within 24 hours he's admitted, and now I have to report that? That seems kind of...
Dr. Snell, come on. That's not going to, that's really extrapolating to a nth degree.
But on here, if there's an admission within 24 hours of being of a dental service, I have to report it. And you have a risk-wise, like with adverse occurrences, someone has a higher risk of getting a car accident than they do having an anesthesia adverse outcome.
Well, I guess you'd have to become, the way that I wrote it, you have to be made aware that they were in a car accident, right? Otherwise, you're still compliant if you weren't made aware. And I would imagine that, let's say, you got made aware and you followed the letter of the law and put a report to the dental board, I would imagine the dental board would immediately just dismiss it and not have any further investigation. Dr. Hero could speak better to that, and Dr. Beanstalk, but that's what I think would happen. But
so there's no, I guess from the dentist provider standpoint, I don't like lots of restrictions and adding more stuff in. So from a dental, because it opens the door to all those types of things, unintended consequences of the rules that we put in. So from a as it reads right now, if something were to happen, I don't have to do any, I'm not responsible as a dental provider, even providing anesthesia, to follow up after 24 hours to make sure nothing happened. I would have to, it would be, the board would say, Dr. Snell, he went to the hospital on his own accord. You didn't know about it. He's suing you, but I didn't know about it. So therefore I don't have anything to worry about.
Okay. I think we should take a vote on this and on the amount of days, but go ahead, Dr. Beanstalk.
Well, I was going to say, would it make you feel more comfortable, Dr. Snell, if we added in potentially caused by the dental anesthesia?
That would make way more sense to me. But I think it's just getting very wordy and detailed when the way it was written before, taking out the just calling EMS but needing to be admitted. Like I think what Dr. Hero was saying in the first place was that if they leave your place with EMS and are admitted, then to me, that's when I need to report it. And that's what I'm trying to outline here. If something happened 24 hours later, now you get into a gray area. You're having to, whose responsibility is that to make sure? I just think you open it up a lot more issues.
And so, I mean, just to be clear, I support the idea of reporting within 24 hours. My concern is making, how do we enforce it? If somebody just says, well, I didn't know about it, right? And if you didn't know, should you have known about it? That's where it gets a little gray.
I agree.
But I think as long as it can be flushed out with appropriate language, I would be pro including the 24-hour window into these adverse occurrences. Jessica.
I just want to point out, you guys have not said anything about removing this language yet. Occurs in a dental office or dental clinic. So if you're going to go the route of making them report if something happens after they've been discharged and gone home or on the way home in a car accident, whatever it is, that doesn't seem to be occurring in the dental office or the dental clinic. So if that's the route you're going to go, we're going to need to remove this language about the incident or the death occurring in the dental office or dental clinic. And then I also wanted to address, I think it was Dr. Beanstock who mentioned something about if it's resulting from dental services or anesthesia, you know, provided in the dental office or the dental clinic. Just from the standpoint of rules and how to identify if something has resulted from a dental service, I think that's getting into some gray area, because I don't know at what point of an incident someone is going to determine whether or not the incident was the result of, you know, the anesthesia or the dental service versus some other, you know, intervening circumstance or something like that. So I would hesitate to put something in there about the incident or the death resulting from the dental services. I think that it might actually be clearer to leave in this language about the incident or the death occurring in the dental office versus trying to identify whether or not the incident or death was the result of a dental service or anesthesia.
Dr. Brady.
Yeah, I think if a patient is admitted to the hospital within 24 hours and they know it, like, I think the board can do an investigation and see, and the provider has to defend himself. Obviously, the board isn't going to go after a car accident, but there are things that, like Jermaine has said, what if it's an apparition pneumonia situation that you should have caught, but you didn't catch it, right? Or it's an MI because they were hypoxic the whole time, or hypotensive, or it's an acute brain injury issue that's not discovered. You know, so I think having the admission to the hospital is a good safeguard for people not to have to activate EMS, but at the same time allow the board to do its work to make sure that these providers are competent providers if something was to happen and let the investigation happen.
Dr. Blazek.
I was just going to kind of say what Dr. Brady just said, and I was actually going to revert back to what he did so well early on, was like to say, what is our objective here? And our objective is to, one, make sure the board knows about patients that go to the dentist and end up in the hospital, and two, that reporting is occurring in a timely fashion. And I was going to discuss, like Dr. Brady did, there's just so many other things that all of us know in anesthesia can happen within 20. So, you know, the consults I had over the past couple of months were patients that were sedated in a dental office, had a heart attack after they went home. Those cases should have been reported. And so the objective here, and that's what we have to focus on, is that the dental board knows what's going on in the dental office, and the reporting is done in a timely fashion. And I think that the paragraph started out really well. It was really simple, and all we wanted to do was add a few little bookends, and we're really getting deep in the woods here. So maybe it's tabled to where it's two or three kind of put it to words, but it's just going really down a rabbit hole again, and all of us on this call are just kind of beating the same dead horse.
Yeah, I agree. That's what I was going to say. Let's just
make a motion and vote on it. But Ali, can you reiterate what you said earlier?
Yeah, that's why I raised my hand, because Jessica, you mentioned not separating out, you know, the dental office or clinic. That's what I was trying to do in my horribly long sentence here, is basically saying there's two reportable events, right? Reportable event is patient dies in the office. Reportable event two is within 24 hours of the treatment, no matter if it's by EMS to the hospital or they go home and then drive themselves to the ER, within 24 hours, if they get admitted to the hospital, then that would be a reportable event if the dentist is made aware of their admission. And then a big part, I think, of us kind of going down this path is the question that you just put there about if they require EMS but do not get admitted to the hospital, that is not a reportable event, because basically that means you did the right thing, you called EMS, they got checked out at a tertiary care facility, a hospital facility, and then they got discharged because they were fine. They got checked out. So you don't have to report that, because we're worried that that might make people less inclined to activate EMS because they might think it's punitive if something happens. But we want them to activate EMS before a patient dies in the office. So,
Jessica, can you take that information and in between right now and the next meeting, write something up that captures what Ali just said, because I think it's representative of what most people at least believe right now, and then we can vote on it at the next meeting.
Yes. Sorry.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Dr. Grimmie.
What if we just kept the EMS notified and or hospital admission within 24 hours? That we have no ability to collect any kind of quality data. And so if I, for example, have a laryngospasm and I'm struggling and I activate EMS and I'm able to, you know, correctly treat the laryngospasm and the kid doesn't end up going to the hospital, I guess the question is, should that be reportable? And my argument would be, I think it should be reportable, not from a punitive standpoint, but I think for the board to know what's happening in dental offices, you know, what's the incidence of laryngospasm, for example? And if we capture EMS activation, we'll capture a lot of that. We may not capture all of it, but I think this information, this data, I think is useful in making decisions. You know, we sit here, we're making decisions about anesthesia sedation, and we argue that, well, based on the 20 cases we reviewed, X, Y, or Z wasn't prevalent. And so, but maybe we didn't capture everything. So I'm just throwing that out there, not to, you know, be the dead horse again, but I would not be opposed to saying that a reportable adverse occurrence would be EMS activation or hospitalization within 24 hours for that purpose.
Dr. Blazing.
Dr. Jermaine, I really appreciate your comment there, and I wholeheartedly support it. And I would even go a step further that what would be great to see is, like, I think a subcommittee, an anesthesia subcommittee that's created that oversees anesthesia in the outpatient setting for dentistry and medicine, and we create a form, much like you guys use in the hospital, that lists opportunity to just mark a checkbox for things that occur in the office, hypoglycemia, hypotension, how you treated it. You didn't even activate EMS. And that is just a self-reporting system that's anonymous that this anesthesia subcommittee would then be able to accumulate data and just, again, go back to the safety and the efficacy of providing in-office anesthesia. Now, I know we're not going to take care of that here in rule. But my point would be to support why an anesthesia committee made up of this type of a constituency would be appropriate.
Well, a potential way we could go with that is, and this would be a question for Ryan and the AG's office, but just to make this existing committee a standing committee that can then, you know, review those things. But we'll that could be a discussion for another day as well. Ollie.
Yeah, just looking at what Jessica wrote, and I guess we got to figure out, because, you know, do we want all EMS transfers to be a reportable event? So you'd put in those, just, can you go back to that? Yeah, right there. So I was, when you first wrote it and when I raised my hand, was you said that patient is discharged but then is admitted. It doesn't, what I was saying was it doesn't matter if they're discharged or if they get transferred by EMS. If they're admitted, that's reportable. But was trying to get away from the potentially punitive part of just activating EMS on its own, but then the patient's fine, and whether or not that should be reported. It seemed like everyone's on the feeling to not report it. What Dr. German's saying makes a lot of sense. So is what Dr. Blazek's saying. You know, in medicine, we have to report on every single case a lot of this information. But the way that they get people to do it, that is if you don't report, Medicare cuts your pay the next year. So there's nothing in dentistry to make sure that people are held accountable to actually report, you know, a hyperglycemic event or a hypertensive or hypotensive event or a transfer, all the various quality measures that we do in medicine that we don't do in dentistry. So I don't know, maybe the committee just needs to, maybe we just need to take a vote of whether or not we want EMS transfer without admission to be a reportable event.
And I think what needs to drive the decision on this is protecting the public, right? I mean, the data collection would be wonderful, but the board doesn't have the capacity right now to act the same way as what like a hospital may be doing, you know, because when you're saying there's all these reportable events, Ollie, I'd imagine you're reporting probably to the hospital, right? You're not reporting to the nursing board every time you have to.
Oh, CMS.
You're what?
CMS.
Right, but you're not reporting it to the nursing board.
Correct.
Dr. German, go ahead.
Is there any idea how many EMS activations we have in the state of Arizona in dental offices per year? I'm just curious what the number is. It may not be that big, so why not include it? But if it's astronomical, then I understand the argument.
To me, kind of regardless of the number, it's just really, it goes back to what's the best way to protect the public, right? And board staff could get those numbers, I'm sure. Dr.
Well, so I mean, if we want to protect the public, then I would suggest we count an EMS activation as a reportable occurrence. It's not right. An offense, but it should be the board to determine what happened and if something was, you know, mispractice, if there's malpractice involved or not.
Well, and I will tell you, we've caught violations on adverse occurrences where EMS was activated, but no transport occurred. So, I mean, there's definitely validity to what you're saying. I don't know who's up next. Jessica, I'll go to you, and then Dr. Arnall, and then Dr. Brady.
So the way that the rule is currently written, it already requires the dentist to report when an incident requires emergency medical responses. So they should already be reporting those as an adverse occurrence. Keeping that in there does not change the rule. It doesn't increase the amount of reporting that's required because that's already part of what they're supposed to be reporting to the board anyway. With regard to whether or not there is any teeth to requiring them to report those types of things, there's no fee or fine or penalty or anything associated with not reporting. But I would imagine that if it comes to light through some sort of complaint or other issue that comes before the board that something happened and it wasn't reported, that would be a violation of the rules, and that would probably go into the board's consideration of whatever issue is before them. And then I would also say that in terms of the board determining issues related to permitting and licensing, particularly for anesthesia permits, I would imagine that that information is very helpful if you have a dentist or a dental professional who is consistently reporting similar adverse occurrences and having issues that are recurring when they are administering anesthesia in a particular way, and that may also go into the board's consideration of the matter before them. If you have that information that this they're having issues with whatever this particular problem is when they're administering anesthesia in a particular way.
Is the nursing board and the medical board, are those providers required to report an EMS activation? Could you answer that?
No. I don't believe they're required to report an EMS activation. No, I know the nursing board were not required to report.
But Ali, if 1602 passes, would that force a requirement of reporting?
Out of a dental office.
Okay. All right.
Dr. Brady, go ahead.
Did you say not? You said.
Yeah, Eddie's question was like, does the nursing board or medical board require you guys to report for a EMS activation? It's a little bit of like apples to oranges, but because they're in the hospital, they're required about a whole bunch of nuances, little things, and they have the bandwidth to do it. And it's not the nursing board or the medical board that has oversight of that. I still like the 24-hour admission. That is my play on. I do think that just activating EMS, I don't want a punitive thing on there if it doesn't do that. If it, you know, I don't want people to fear that. However, I do like capturing data. I did that whole presentation on reporting and data quite some time ago. I think it was like over a year or two ago that was coming up as an agenda item. That hopefully we do get a lot of data reporting for the near misses, because that's what really matters, especially with the idea with Randy has talked about forming this like invest this committee to like look at a lot of these things. I think that's going to be very, very helpful. And I think if we do kind of what I had that idea in mind for reporting and data collection to a PSO, it's going to help quite a bit. I mean, I know it was a hallmark moment for aviation and safety in aviation. And so I completely understand that trying to capture those near misses and those nuances. But I think there's a way to do this where it's not so penalizing for that.
I think it's my turn. Is that right? Did we lose Anthony?
He quit. He gave up.
Maybe we'll give him just a moment to get back on.
I yield my time to Matt Arnell.
Real quick, though, Matt, sorry. I don't know if it's necessary.
Yeah, go ahead.
Apples to oranges. I mean, there's plenty of outpatient facilities that provide outpatient care, urology, and you know, some of our other clinics. You know, that's why I was asking. And these outpatient facilities, are they required? If somebody they act at EMS, are they required to report as a physician or as a nurse?
So, Eddie, I can answer that question. We are required to report to the medical staff of that facility. So if I'm at an outpatient facility for Banner or for, you know, Phoenix Children's Hospital where I work, and we have to activate EMS for a transfer to the hospital or activate them at all, we are required to report that to the, you know, the perioperative medical directors of those facilities who then report it to the medical staff. So they are portable incidents. We don't go right to the board because the board does not, again, oversee the practices in those facilities.
And one step further, I know that, you know, the first responders, firefighters and such, they track what facilities are calling them as well. So they're keeping a tally on it to know what facilities are activating EMS. But But yeah, like Dr. German said, the nursing board or the medical board don't get a report. It goes through other avenues. So it does get reported, just not to the nursing board, medical board.
Dr. Arnell.
Thank you for the clarification.
So I think everybody understands the value of data. But I, you know, I speak to a lot of providers all over the state, and for years people, this problem that people are afraid to call EMS is very real. And I think we need to remember our charge isn't to collect data. Our charge is to protect the public. And if we were to say simply activating EMS is not reportable, that it, you know, it's death or it's admission, I think we would have a tremendous improvement of protection and safety to our patients, because it's a very ubiquitous fear of providers in the state to call EMS because they're afraid to report to the board. I think initially when we were saying, yes, let's not make EMS be the event that gets reported, I think we were making a big step forward for the safety of our patients. But if it were to continue to be reportable, I like what Jason was saying, you know, the FAA, they created a system where, in essence, like if we were to make it the same for dentistry, like let's say the patient's transported but not admitted, they could report that without punishment, right? In the FAA, I think if they weren't, if there was no injuries or whatever, they could report events without punishment or something to that effect. Even that, I think we're getting into things that will be like such a headache for the board. I think it should be simple and clear cut. And if we're just going for safety, I think it's a lot more safe to have all of our providers in the state feel totally confident calling EMS.
I think this is something we should have Jessica work on and then vote at the next meeting. I don't even really want to call that vote right now. Jessica?
Yeah, I'm happy to work on some language and to kind of put all of these questions and suggestions into something that you guys can consider at your next meeting. I did have a question because you guys keep using the term EMS, which I'm thinking stands for Emergency Medical Services. But yes. The term in the rule is actually emergency medical response. And so I'm wondering, what does emergency medical response mean? Is that the same as calling 911 from the dental office, or does that mean that you have to do some sort of emergency medical procedure in the office, not necessarily requiring you to call 911, if that makes sense?
Dr. Lau. You're muted, Dr. Lout.
Sorry. I would probably go with emergency medical services. I think that's kind of the standard, and I think everybody can identify with that.
I think when I hear requires emergency medical response, my brain thinks they called 911. But
this is Jessica. I'm glad I asked, because when I originally read this rule, I did not think 911 at all. My first thought was that somebody, either the anesthesia provider or the supervising dentist or somebody in the office, was performing CPR or something of that nature, you know, providing some sort of medication to counteract whatever was going on with the patient. So that's what I was thinking when I read emergency medical response. And it sounds like that's not what this rule was trying to get at. It was actually trying to get at emergency response personnel.
Yes.
Okay, then I think we should wrap up. I think Jessica has some work to do behind the scenes. Dr. Brady, we appreciate everything you did today and working with her on that language for our next meeting as well. As far as our next agendized meeting, it's on April 21st. is everybody okay if we do like another 2 o'clock meeting? I don't think we need an all day one.
Yeah.
Yeah. Dr. Brady, you got your hand up?
Yeah. Is there any way just to pull up real quick that language I put in that little text file for the 1602?
Jessica, is that something you can do?
Are you asking for what you put in the in-meeting texting or something that you had sent via email?
Something I had sent via email. It came with the same, it was one of the attachments as what.
Yasmin, is that something you can do?
Could you repeat the question? Do you want me to present something?
Yes. If you can share the 1602 language that Dr. Brady emailed earlier this month.
I see. Okay. One moment.
So I'll be really quick about this, but basically what I wanted to share with everyone here is that there is language in other states where the board from one board has jurisdiction of any individual that's in their sphere, right? In their wheelhouse of a dental office or a hospital. In fact, Vermont has some language on this where it's allowing dentists to administer non-dental anesthesia in their facilities, but the board keeps them to that standard, and the medical board can actually have the same kind of consequence to them to allow to have a disciplinary action on them. And so if you think about this in reverse, it answers a lot of questions and concerns that the dental board should have, like, really the authority to say which individuals can and cannot be in the dental office. One can read it that way. And so my hopes is that the 1602 provides an avenue for that. In fact, if you read what Arizona is, like how I would envision it, it's really two simple sentences. And it's saying that everyone is on the same standard and the dental board can say, take a hike because you've already had two adverse events in a year or whatever that is, right? They have the ability to investigate bad apples. And so it is my hope that the people that can influence the 1602 bill to think about, you know, where's the jurisdiction lies. And really, we don't want too many cooks in the kitchen. And I think this helps eliminate a lot of issues. So that's all that I wanted to say on that. But I think it's very relevant, and I think it works, and it helps cultivate a culture where everyone is working together too. And I think we've done that with the 1304 as best we can to this point, but I'm hoping the 1602 can be catered where it does help all boards and all parties of interest.
Thank you, Dr. Brady. Any comments or discussion on that? Then I would make a motion to adjourn the meeting.
Second, Lazik.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
Aye.
Motion passes, none opposed. Thank you, everybody. Appreciate it.